of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary here for November 15, 2007.
And I'm going to call to order a subcommittee of the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. And for colleagues, I have one member who apparently had dental surgery and is having, let's say, some complications, and so she will not be joining us at all. That's Senator Burdick. And then Senator Walker apparently was scheduled to be in court, in federal court today, but she is supposed to be available by phone if and when we need to have her. So we're going to start as a subcommittee, and Mr. Chair, we'll let you go ahead and lead off.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will open now an informational meeting on the subject of driving while suspended. Let's see, we're going to lead off then with Representative Flores and Senator Winters.
If Linda doesn't mind, I will lead off. I need to go to the hospital. I have Ted there, my husband, right now, getting a cardiac conversion. So I'm going to keep my comments brief. But I wanted to share where we are on a committee that a work group that I pulled together. And it's kind of interesting because I think all of us would agree, for the record, I'm State Senator Jackie Winters, representing District 10. And I think all of us will agree that driving is a privilege and not a right, and that it should be treated as such. Unfortunately, some Oregon drivers disagree with this premise and may present a safety risk to themselves and others by driving not only under the influence but unlicensed and with their license suspended, revoked, or with low insurance. The ultimate offense is one resulting often in the injury of others or in some cases even death. It was the death of a 77-year-old Salem man, a Salem resident, last summer by an unlicensed driver that caused outrage not only of myself but of other lawmakers as well as the general public. My immediate reaction was to convene a bipartisan work group to discuss options to present during the 2008 supplemental session. The result of this work group, which I convene, and there's been, I believe, two, maybe three meetings, included legislators, law enforcement, ODOT, DMV, judges, attorneys, and as well as we had our local sheriff. And there were many issues and critical ideas that were discussed. And we also had background that was provided to us by legislative counsel. And a part of that discussion also focused on the strike plates, and the zebra stripe, and LC currently is looking at that and is actually preparing some language for the 2008 session. And unfortunately, I don't have that with me today to share with you because it's still in process. But I can share with you that we felt that this was only a beginning point of the discussion, that clearly that, and I hope that this body and others in this building take a very hard look at this whole issue of individuals in our community that are driving one without a license. In the case of the individual in Salem, I believe there was something like 16 citations. And yet they continue to drive. And the other issue is the revocation. I believe that in 2006, there were 48,861 DWSRs. And it's kind of interesting because to me what it says that even though we have laws on the books and we have certain requirements or certain segments of our population that says it's okay for you to abide by the law but not me. And I think that we must begin to examine and look at this issue. And there's many facets to it. and I'm sure that Reggie Flores will talk about other elements that are involved, but I think it deserves our scrutiny. I think it deserves us coming up in a bipartisan way with solutions. I ask myself the question, if you continue to allow, even though it's a small percentage of the population, to not abide by the law, eventually there will be others who don't want to abide by the laws, and that will begin to grow. So I'm going to turn it over to Linda, but I would share with you the individuals who are part of this work group. The work group consists of Senator Courtney, Senator Beyer, Senator Larry George and Gary George, and myself and Senator Ferrioli, along with the House, because I thought we really do need both sides of the chamber, is Representative Berger. Comp has indicated that she wanted to be a part of the group. Cameron, Clem, and Thatcher, as well as ODOT, which included Lorna Young, who has been elevated and now has a higher position than DMV, and Troy and with traffic safety, Jack Evans, who is here today with ODOT, and Greg Olson with Marion County Sheriff's. We did not have, and I think that you will hear from the state police with their comments with respect to the zebra stripe plates. It's probably controversial. It's my understanding that the evidence of whether or not it was successful or not, once the report that was given to us, was the state discontinued doing it and went ahead and sunset it before they had the final report that actually said that it worked in Oregon but did not work in Washington. I hope that ODOT will give you a copy of that particular report, because I think the information contained therein can be valuable as you look at this whole issue. And with that, I will open for any questions that you may have. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you, and now I'll go see about Ted.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. Our hopes and prayers are on the side.
Mr. Chair, before we get on, I didn't neglect to say that Senator Beyer also had a work commitment, being in the middle of his season for getting trees out, so he was not able to join us today either.
Representative Flores.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair McPherson, Chair Posonski, members. It just so happens that the issue, having been in the news during the summer and fall, did stimulate a lot of discussion, concern from my constituents, and it was just kind of one of those mutual occurrences that Senator Winters and I had both had on our radar screen work groups to address this very issue. So I think that a lot of the work that came out of both of our groups is very mutual and collaborative, and I'd like to just give you a little bit more background and information in regard to the driving while suspended, DWS, and driving while revoked matter. And again, in regard to the recent headlines, October 19th, 2007, a 45-year-old woman was crossing the street with a friend, and she was struck and killed by a blue pickup speeding through the intersection that took off. The driver, a 39-year-old Robert Berryhill, was charged with felony hit and run and driving while his license was suspended. He had a criminal record for multiple DUI offenses and other charges dating back nearly 20 years. October 22, 2007, so we're just talking a few weeks ago, a garbage truck smashes into a 31-year-old bicyclist in southeast Portland. The victim is dead on the scene. The driver was not cited in that instance, but he had 25 traffic violations on his record for over the past 20 years, including multiple driving without a valid license. And then another example from August of 07, 24-year-old Kendarine Hudson, suspected of shoplifting in Beaverton, led police on a chase, high-speed chase, that eventually ended when the cops put spike strips down in southeast Portland, and her 3-year-old toddler was in the back seat. And it turned out in the past 7 years, she had been cited for driving while suspended 43 times. In fact, she never had a valid driver's license. So after a series of those types of headlines, we tend to focus on, is this an issue we should be putting under our microscope. And with that, we did convene a work group, and so on page one of this particular handout, you'll see a list of the participants, invitees and participants, representatives from law enforcement, district attorneys, criminal defense lawyers, judges, vehicle dealers, and others, and I'm sure a lot of them that sat in on our work group were in Senator Winter's work group as well. And they joined us to dive into the issue and look for suggested changes that might have the greatest impact. We did have three meetings, lots of email exchanges, and a ton of research to weed through. We talked to other state and national organizations to gather information about specifically National Conference of State Legislatures and the American Association for Motor Vehicle Administrators, also known as AMBA. In fact, that organization just had a very comprehensive study done, national study, and working with National Highway Traffic Safety Administration on this very issue, and they are expected to have a report released in the next few weeks, so we're looking forward to the information that will be provided in that. We were fortunate because the Municipal Judges Association, which includes Justices of the Peace, and that's an element of the discussion that we had as well, as far as courts of record. You might recall we heard some couple of bills regarding courts of record, discussed the issue at our request and at their state conference, and they gave us some good feedback from around the state. The Police Chiefs Association also put out a survey for us, getting responses from 53 cities and state police. The number one priority was impounding vehicles, followed by enhanced penalties, zebra stickers, vehicle forfeiture, plate seizures, and other options. A little background about driving while suspended in Oregon. Driving while suspended, or driving while revoked, is not a new problem. But it, as I mentioned, it has been getting more attention lately, and the public is, of course, when you hear a lot of attention high on the visibility screen, the public wants us to address those issues. 40 or 50 years ago, this was a pretty serious crime in Oregon. The first offense got you a minimum of 2 days in jail or up to 1 year. The third strike landed you at least a month behind bars. Plus, you lost your license, your vehicle registration, and possibly your plates. Times change, jail beds fill up with more serious offenders. We all know we're dealing with that. Now, most DWSs result in traffic violations with a fine of up to $720, possibly. The most serious felony charge has an underlying reason for being suspended, like manslaughter. That could bring a fine up to $250,000 and a 10-year prison sentence. But it's an underlying cause. The reality is, even though someone can be charged with DWS, misdemeanor / felony, it's almost always knocked down to a violation. In fact, we know presiding judges in the metro area instruct their peers on the bench to reduce more serious charges to violations. DMV reports that 92% are violations and 8% are misdemeanors. Most states have some type of fines and additional suspension periods if you're busted for driving while suspended. They also have laws that allow them to impound the vehicle. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates around 80% of those with suspended or revoked licenses continue to operate a motor vehicle. 80% continue to operate a motor vehicle. Drivers know there are no harsh consequences, and it's like an invisible or undetectable traffic violation because there's really no way to know if someone is suspended without pulling them over or running their plates. The national experts estimate that 18% of all fatal crashes involve a driver with an improper license in one form or another. In Oregon, DMV is here today, and they'll go over some numbers in more detail, but we're talking about basically 10% of the driving population in Oregon has a suspended license. So there potentially are tens of thousands of people who could be out there driving with a suspended license every day. And there are multiple offenders, like we heard about earlier, In fact, we found out about one man who got his license suspended for 15 years. Oh, he was suspended 15 years ago, and he never tried to get it reinstated. It has been suspended for various reasons 77 times since 1991. And on top of that, he's had 21 convictions for driving while suspended, plus 17 additional convictions for other driving violations. There are tiers of offenders here, low, mid, and high-level offenders, and one of the things that we heard from just about everyone in the work group is a need to separate the different level of offenders. And basically, we have two levels: low-level offenders who made a bad choice, they didn't file an accident report, they didn't pay their child support, which is an administrative suspension, or whatever, and they had their license suspended. Now, they have a big fine that is growing, they can't afford to pay it, and they can't use the bus or get their kids to the doctor's office. So they drive their car and they get nailed for driving while suspended. Again. Now they have a suspension that went from 60 days to a year or whatever else, and their fine's double, and they still can't pay it. And that's one group. And I'd like to be able to help sort that out a little bit, because that creates some burdensome paperwork in the court system, actually. Then there are the harder core offenders who have several DWS convictions, and they don't care. They continue to drive. We've had one report of a guy with $15,000 in back fines, but he didn't care, and he kept driving. These are the scofflaws. They might get their license back someday, but they need to face some serious consequences first. There's actually an even higher level offender, and that's the one who's been revoked for life already, who's facing some harsher punishments, again, because of other serious crimes like driving under the influence, criminally negligent homicide, and those types of issues. So what are some possible solutions? Our work group talked about a wide variety of things and the pros and cons of each. Of course, resources are always an issue. We know that. We acknowledge that. So we kept that in front and center of our deliberations. What I did think, where we did reach consensus, were on a couple of issues, and that are possible considerations for us to move forward as we refine and review possible legislative action. Number one is in regard to traffic court for low-level offenders. That would be modeled after drug court programs. It could be like once a week or once a month, and under that scenario, a judge would have more flexibility to work with offenders, make deals where they pay off a certain portion of their fines, maybe do community service for part of the money that they owe, and perhaps they need to show the judge proof of insurance before he'll work with them on getting their license back. The judges need more flexibility than our current law provides in order to make this a workable program. Another problem our work group talked about is once a court gives you back the legal right to drive or to have a license, a lot of folks think they're done. They come out of court, judge says okay, but they don't realize that they have to go down to the Department of Motor Vehicles to do the paperwork, go through the process. And that kind of traffic court model would help facilitate the right kind of connection between the agencies. And I'll just kind of have you reflect back on the presentation we heard during the last legislative session, the clean slate model, where they have agencies working together. And it's a wonderful startup program, and I know you're familiar with it, Representative Shields. The second consideration is in regard to tiered or graduated penalties for higher level, what we'll call frequent flyers. We haven't really broken down how such a three-strike concept would work, but we're thinking, let's say, go for the fourth time you get cited for driving while suspended or driving while revoked. You would see a higher fine. You'd possibly face some arrest. You'd get booked in the jail, fingerprinted, and sit in a holding cell with other harder core criminals overnight, even a few hours. The point is, we want to get their attention. Kind of a scared straight approach. This could be community service, work camps, week in jail, and other penalties that would then follow from that initial confinement. The higher level of punishment for DWS offenders would coincide with a third proposal, which would involve, number three, plate or car impoundment. Impounding plates on the car. Under current law, police can tow and impound cars for driving while suspended. Some agencies use that law more than others. Some use tow companies to store vehicles, some don't. So sometimes it's a space issue. By impounding the plate off the car, you avoid the storage problem. Immobilization is also a popular idea, and it's using a boot or a tire or on a tire or a club on the steering wheel. The idea is to target the vehicle and separate the car from the offender. The concept of using plates or seizing plates has been used successfully in several other states, including Ohio, Minnesota, and Michigan. One option is for the officer on the scene to confiscate the plate then and there at the time of the stop, and the plates are destroyed. If they keep driving the car, if the person keeps driving the car, the police have the probable cause to pull them over. They don't do this in Minnesota. They do this in Minnesota, and the recidivism rate went down 50%. Some states issue a paper registration when they seize the plate, or a special license plate is issued in a certain color or marking that stands out so that an officer knows one of the drivers of this car has a suspended license and they can pull it over. Whoever's driving has to, of course, produce proof that they have a valid license. This way, other family members who have licenses can still get to the grocery store or take kids to school or whatever. We did address the family use of the vehicle, and that we were focused on that as well. Vehicle impoundment is also a very effective option. In Ohio and California, they've seen reductions in repeat offenses and crashes. In California, the average rate of subsequent DWS was 24% lower than for offenders whose vehicles were not impounded, and a 38% decrease in crashes for repeat offenders. Using the boot and the club has been effective in Ohio, New Mexico, Wisconsin, and Michigan. In fact, in Ontario, Canada, they have a law to tow and impound if you loaned your car to someone who has a suspended license. And we're not advocating that here, but we would rather have a more sensible approach. What about Department of Motor Vehicle changes? We would also like to see some changes at DMV to prevent the stop laws from finding loopholes or creating them. For example, if you seize the car, right now they'll go to a used car lot, shop for a license plate that has a tag on it that still has time left on the registration. They'll buy the car and they'll start driving it. We need to take the plates off of those cars and require the new owner to go to DMV and get the car re-registered with new tags, new plates. We also need to require title transfer to the new owner. This is not currently required. So if you sell your car to someone and the title is not transferred over to the new owner, you could be getting a call from the tow company saying your car was towed and impounded and you can pay the bill. There were many other areas that we discussed, but we tried to narrow it down to a few where we could make an impact and try to get some of these offenders off the road. So thank you for your attention. I hope that you will look through the packet of information as far as some of the recommendations that we did discuss or areas that we did discuss, the vehicle code sanctions that are currently in place, partial history of the driving while suspended issue, and the current laws, which you'll find on the last page. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Representative Flores, very interesting. The first question is, have any of the states looked at the forfeiture of the vehicle on like the second or third tier level of offenses? That would seem to me to be the ultimate deterrent. You just take the car. You know, you're convicted again for the second or third tier offense. You just simply don't have a car to drive.
Well, that is the impoundment question, and then who ultimately would be the titular head or the owner of the vehicle is the question. Can you take it away from them permanently? I'm not sure that any state does that specifically, but they have done the impoundment piece.
Mm-hmm. I understand the impoundment piece, but it seems like the logical conclusion that if you're as you say, a stop law, you just don't get your car back. And then the other thing, question, if I may.
Okay.
On the re-registering the car or getting other plates and so forth, I mean, you're talking about taking the plates off of all vehicles. Wouldn't that be rather a large revenue source for the state?
We had a lot of discussion about the revenue question, and I think that what we ultimately get to is that we're basically losing revenue as it is. And if we do a shift, a paradigm shift in how we go about doing business, there ultimately will be an increase. And why are we losing revenue? Well, because there's a lot of money owed as a result of all these outstanding citations that never get paid. The logjam in the courts. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Witt. I'm sorry, was it using proper protocol? Ultimately, never get paid. But if we do something that would change how we do business, there would be some revenue coming back into the system, real revenue, not just on the books that we know we'll never collect.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Flores, for your presentation. Did you run across any data, or do you know if it's there is an ability to ascertain how many of the people who are caught driving while suspended are driving a car where they are the sole user of that car? And how many are the family situations where there may be somebody else in the family depending on the car?
You know, I don't know that we had it narrowed down to that specific piece as far as who was, and I'm looking back at my crack research assistant back here, Don Phillips, and I don't know that statistics are kept on sole user versus family. I know there would probably be some input that might get to that question somewhere from DMV.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and just to thank you, Representative Flores, and being able to have been on both committees, on Senator Winters and yours, and I think to help clarify or some of the things that were discussed on the impound issue that the senator brought up, a lot of these cars are very low value. They get impounded. And so rather than me, if I'm a habitual driver, rather than me going back and trying to pay the fines and get the car, I just go to a used car dealer that has cars for $500 and I buy a new car, and I'm not forced under our new registration issue, if we really had to take those license plates off, if the person that sold that car had to take those license plates off, force the individual to go to the DMV to register the car, we would have a flag here that would slow some things down. That was one of the issues. And then under the revenue issue that you brought up, there was the possibility that, for example, if I sold my car to you, I would take those plates off, and those plates would stay with me as I purchased another car somewhere down the road. I wouldn't have to get totally new plates. I would pay for some sort of title transfer registration fee as I do now. So I thought that those were some really good points that were brought up in the committee, especially with the issue of the impound that you brought up, because it's cheaper for me to go buy a new car than to come back and pay all the fees and the fines, and I just continue on as a third-tier offender.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
And you will hear testimony from some of the participants in the work group also in regard to some of those issues.
Council Chair, members of the committee, I just want to remind you, as it relates to forfeitures in Oregon, it's a little bit more difficult. We have a constitutional amendment, and basically it requires a criminal conviction. The other problem with forfeitures and impoundment that you have is any lien holder will take first. You cannot wipe out their claim. And then in forfeitures, the proceeds is a whole set of series of how the proceeds must be spent. So the bottom line in this, be it forfeitures or be it impoundment, is basically someone in government's going to have to pick up the cost.
Representative, thank you for your presentation. Since the work I do as a prosecutor covers a lot of this area, I'm kind of intrigued because if my officers in Florence, they do impound vehicles. articles on DWSs and DWRs, habitual offenders and such. One of the things that I'm not sure if you how far your committee went as to the number of the DWSs that we have and the different tiers, because the vast majority of DLs, driver's license I review on their records, the vast majority of them are violations, and it's as simple as not complying with a court order, not paying a fee. It's not that they're out there per se causing traffic citations to be issued for other issues. It says they have not been suspended administratively, as you mentioned. And those people are ones that are the lower tier, are the ones that you're probably going to see the most repetitiveness of the number of suspensions that they have against them. And I'm not sure how we are going to get around dealing with those individuals, because one of the proposals I understand is maybe having enhanced, not only penalties, but enhanced charging, that as people get more, they're going to get now, instead of sanctioned as a violation, just because they've had five violations, now they're going to be cited as a misdemeanor. And I think we may have some problems there as to the constitutional protections that they would have, meaning that we'd have to start giving attorneys
counsel
to those individuals at the violation level.
Yeah.
I am very concerned by the statement that you made, that you said courts, and I have to assume prosecutors, are actually dropping these charges down below. And I'm not sure exactly how that's happening in the court as compared to, I know as a prosecutor, as if you're going to do negotiations, that might be what some people would call a throwaway, because it is only a violation as compared to getting someone to admit or be found guilty of a crime, which is going to have more, sanctions available to them. I'd love to get more information as to how that's happening at the court level, and also where the prosecutors are, ODAA, because if they're working with this work group, it seems to me this is a charging issue, and if they're basically making a discretion their decision that they're not going to charge someone as a crime but as a violation to get some type of deal, are we going to now mandate that they have to be charged based on what the actual offense is and not allow them to negotiate those out, which could also have increased costs to processing those people through the system? The other part on the underlying, you mentioned as to the felonies, there are underlying cause. Also, the misdemeanors are too, such as if you have someone that's convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants, and that's what the suspension is for, they have a mandatory minimum fine of $1,000. And I do know also that from what you, and then if it's not a conviction for that type of offense, such as a DUII, if they have been suspended because they failed to take the breath test or they failed the breath test that they took, those don't have a mandatory minimum sentencing component to it. But it's interesting as to some of the suggestions that are coming up to me are already in place, and at least some jurisdictions are following them. So is the work group saying we're going to mandate this statewide, require all jurisdictions to have to use the tools that we've already put in their toolbox?
Thank you for very well summarizing a whole lot of the discussion that we have had.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, and criminal defense lawyers were very much involved in the discussions and the deliberations. I'm not anxious necessarily to meet another mandate. And yes, there are tools in the toolbox. They are used within the purview of the community setting or the court within which they are being heard. Senator, what I will say is that some of the things that you have brought up, or all of the things that you just addressed, are concerns that we have talked about. And my concern is that we know those things, and Bill Taylor was very good to bring up the constitutional concern in Brown v. Multnomah County regarding do we have now to provide, if you're considering these changes, counsel for anybody that has a certain amount of, that conviction. Now we have to step into yet another area, resource question. We need to know all of those things, but I'm more interested in knowing the problems so that we can find where we can find an area of agreement so that there is a solution. I'm not sure that it's a mandate, Senator. And maybe it's a matter of more effectively using the resources that are available. Maybe it's realigning how we do some of those things. I don't have a specific answer for you today, but I know that we've done we've torn back some layers here and looked at a significant problem.
There's no doubt this is a problem. It's an issue that we as Oregonians want to continue to address. But you know, the traffic court model, I'm not sure exactly what that is. My court, it's a municipal court. It does have what I would refer to as a traffic court model for violations. But if it's a crime, my office is involved in those cases, and I have to make a decision as to whether I'm going to negotiate that down for a plea to something else or not. It seems to me that maybe one of the areas is looking at the conduct that maybe someone enters into once they've been suspended as to trying to get a new license plate, quote-unquote new license plate, on that car, or going out and purchasing another vehicle and just driving it. Maybe there's ways of putting some laws in effect that those would be new type of criminal charges that could be filed against that individual. Because one of the concerns that y'all have definitely addressed is if you have a family in a rural setting, there's only one car, we take that car, and if it's the husband that is the bad actor here, then the wife is not able to use that car, and what have we done for that family?
We've made provision for that. There's a mechanism to make some care for that as well. And so, yep, I understand and love to have you enter into the conversation as we explore this a little bit. But I'm also very anxious for you to hear some of the other presentations and Jeff Levy from Oregon State Police. I would like to also let you know that I've had conversations with a number of retired law enforcement individuals, and they're very concerned about this. They see it as a possible way to recapture some revenue, and they're very interested in seeing plates follow the person, not the vehicle. So that's also something to contemplate.
We do have several other witnesses to appear on this
thank
subject.
We're
well into the hour that have been allotted. So, Representative Shields, did you have a question that we could handle briefly? Or
yeah, I think this would be brief, Mr.
Okay.
Chair, if you can indulge me. Thank you, Representative Flores, for, I think, very thorough testimony and work on this area. I just want to make sure I understood what you're saying, that there are two principles that you want any proposal to have moving forward. One is that it focused on the highest risk, kind of repeat offenders, right? And then two, that you feel part of that should have significant judicial discretion so that when somebody, say, comes out of 5 years of addiction and is genuinely trying to turn their life around, that there's some negotiation there so that whatever price they pay is one that can actually be paid as opposed to something that's astronomical that they'll never be able to dig themselves out of. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Shields, yes, absolutely. That clean slate, second start, new beginning approach is very much a consideration that I held as a priority in this as well.
Great. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify.
Very good. Well, I think we'll have to move on to our other witnesses now.
Thank
so thank you, Representative. We have next in order here, the names of witnesses. I see Tom McClellan from the DMV and Jack Evans. It makes sense for the two of you to come up together then. And I see that they're, your names appear elsewhere here on the subject matter, so I don't know if you're going to comment on all the items in which you're identified as
Jack
having information for us.
Mr. Mosquito, I think you have this in the pile. Chair McPherson, members of the committees, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and here today with me is Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator, to address these the issues related to driving while suspended and driving while revoked. I'm going to go over some of the data and talk a little bit. I won't repeat some of the items that Representative Flores went into. And then Tom McClellan will be discussing one of the programs, which is the zebra law, the zebra stripe law. Currently, we have in Oregon 2.85 approximately million licensed drivers. Every year, 250,000 of those drivers have their driving privileges suspended or revoked. And this represents about 9% of the driving population. Took a look at the period of time from 2003 through 2006. and looking at suspensions and revocations. And that study revealed that about 41,000 individuals on average received convictions for DWS or DWR, driving while suspended and revoked, each year. So this is a relatively small segment, 1.4% of the total driving population, but it is a segment that apparently continues to drive while suspended or revoked. Representative Flores described the history of the laws in Oregon back in 50 years ago. The laws were a bit different. They've evolved over this period of time. In 55, DMV was required by law to direct law enforcement to pick up license plates for people that were failed to surrender them for convictions of DWS or DWR. In the 60s, drivers receiving a first conviction for DWS spent a minimum of 2 days in jail. And a third or subsequent conviction was 30 days. So constraints on resources, both in terms of law enforcement personnel, jail space. Over the years, there has been less of an ability to enforce these laws, and they've have evolved over that period of time. There are currently in 1979, the law that required DMV to ask law enforcement to go retrieve license plates was changed from shall to may, and that was essentially a budget-cutting device. Currently in the law, the underlying reasons for suspensions or revocations determine how long an individual will be suspended, and the violation can result in a fine of $720, a misdemeanor fine of $6,250, up to 1 year suspension, and a Class B felony carries a maximum of $250,000 and up to a 10-year suspension. I should point out that the vast majority of individuals receive violations. 92.5% of those with DWS, DWR receiving violations. 7.4% are misdemeanors, and a tenth of a percent are represented by felonies. Another program that is in effect in Oregon is the habitual offender law. And this is a program that allows licenses to be revoked for a period of 5 years if an individual is considered a habitual offender. And that you can achieve that status in one of two ways. One is by acquiring, in a period of 5 years, three major offenses. And that could be manslaughter, DUI, reckless driving, fleeing or attempting to elude a police officer. Three of those major offenses in a five-year period, you would receive the designation of a habitual offender, and you'd be revoked for 5 years. A second way is by accumulating 20 moving violations in a five-year period, and that could be any kind of a violation from disobeying a traffic signal to careless driving, speeding. An accumulation of 20 of those in a five-year period would have you'd see your license revoked for 5 years.
Mr. Evans?
Yes.
Wouldn't hit and run also be one of the major traffics that would also qualify for habitual?
Chairman McPherson, Senator Prezansky, that's my understanding. In about every year, there are 1,300 of these habitual offender revocations issued. And the most common, I should note, is for DUI. Currently, the law allows courts to order the impoundment or immobilization of vehicles, as Representative Flores pointed out. And it also allows law enforcement to order the impoundment or immobilization of a vehicle without prior notice. When law enforcement has probable cause to believe a person is committing a driving while suspended or revoked offense. So suspended drivers represent about 9% of the Oregon driving population. It's unknown exactly how many people are out there that continue to drive, but the evidence from those that get caught suggests that there is a group that it's difficult to separate from their vehicles. With law enforcement resources stretched thin and the jails experiencing overcrowding, the options available to DMV and the law enforcement community appear to be limited. We have also talk a little bit about this sheet of statistics that you received separately. Again, there are about 41,000 individuals on average that get DWS, DWR convictions each year. We have broken out the number of convictions by court-ordered court-ordered conviction-based suspensions and those administrative suspensions that are performed by DMV, such as the driver improvement program or failure to file an accident report. Those are things that DMV does automatically. So we're looking at over 430,000 different suspensions for various reasons, 250,000 people on average getting suspended every year, and we're looking at around 41,000 people on average each year getting convicted of DWS or DWR. If you look at that over a period of 5 years, and if you were to implement a program that the three strikes and you're out, that Representative Flores spoke of, and perhaps you said Representative four strikes and you're out, but if it were three strikes, I have the numbers for that, it's about 33,000 individuals over a period of 5 years have received three or more convictions for DWS or DWR. And of that group, the convictions, 92.5% of those fall into the violation category. Misdemeanors are 7.4%, and felonies represent 0.1%. So you could say, if you were estimating what the impact on courts might be, that 33,000 individuals divided by 5 years is 6,600 people a year get these convictions. 6,105 of them represent individuals with violations. So those are the ones, if you were to criminalize that, those are the individuals, the types of numbers you'd be looking at for defense attorneys or whatever costs would be involved. So that's a kind of a picture of a very complicated area. DMV is dealing with this in an administrative fashion. We recognize that law enforcement and courts are dealing with resource constraints, and we look forward to working with the various partners from various agencies and the legislature and coming up with a solution to see if we can put a dent in this.
Mr. Evans, I didn't want to put on the record, I didn't see it in the summary here, there is another type of suspension or ban revocation, which is a lifetime ban, which affects individuals that I believe have third conviction for DUI, right. Lifetime ban, which equals at least 10 years that they are prohibited from driving, then they can apply back through the court system. So do we have any numbers of how that's working? Because that's more of a newer suspension that we've created, I believe, probably about 4 years back, maybe six.
Chairman Pearson, Senator Provansky, your question was to the effectiveness of that.
Do we have numbers? Have y'all been tracking as to how many people are now caught up under the lifetime ban based on multiple DUI convictions, and what's happening with those individuals as to tracking if they're getting other vehicles? Because, I mean, we all realize that just because you take someone's license away doesn't mean that they're not going to get a set of car keys from somebody or somehow. or go out and just buy another car right now because there's not that check and balance.
Yes.
And those are, to me, I would assume from what the committee or the work group had been working on, probably our highest level of concern. Here's somebody that's actually has three convictions for driving under the influence of intoxicants, and the court has done everything by paper that it can do, and maybe we need to look at what type of sanctions would be, let's say, justified in those type of cases.
Chairman Pearson, Senator Posansky, I don't have those numbers with me, but we can certainly get that for you.
Okay. Thank you, Sheldon. Mr. Chair, question. Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Mr. Evans, in your closing statement, you mentioned that the DMV is working administratively on this issue. What things are we doing within the rulemaking process administratively to help with this issue?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Cameron, when I said working administratively, I meant in terms of administering the laws and administering the suspensions that are, in a sense, automatic or not court-involved. I wasn't talking about coming up with a solution specifically for DWS. We're going to be working with partners, but unless Tom McClellan has something up his sleeve, I don't believe we have a solution for you, but we're certainly interested in pursuing that.
Okay. Follow up if I may.
Go ahead.
And I know we'll probably hear more testimony in regards to that. You mentioned that if we criminalize this, we'd end up with 6,100 people that potentially need legal service. So is there, we heard some earlier testimony we've heard in our work group about the ability to purchase a car. Has there been talk, or will that be one of the things to talk about keeping a license plate? So an individual that has a habitual problem that just goes out and buys a new car, that they would have to be forced to go to the DMV or be driving around without a license on their car.
Chairman Pearson, Representative Cameron, that's certainly something we want to take a look at, and those various varieties of that concept have arisen over the years. It's something we'll take a look at, but to the extent that it changes the system dramatically, there's a fairly significant cost associated with it, depending upon the way you approach that. So we'll be looking at solutions, but we'll also be realistic as to the impact that'll have on Oregonians in general and the costs involved.
I think the other part on this is if you have someone, let's say, individual selling their vehicle to someone else, and we're going to require that individual to retain the plate of the car, then how does that car get moved from the place where it's been purchased? And so then we're looking at potentially some type of very limited temporary license, I would assume. That would have to be done, but then are we going to have that as a packet that you and I would have to have if we're selling a car at our house as compared to someone off of a lot? So I think there's some issues that have to be dealt with.
Yes.
Senator Whitson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, you comment here that there's currently 2.85 million licensed drivers in Oregon. So there's only about 3.6 million people in Oregon, so that runs about 80% of them have driver's licenses. That seems extremely high. Will you comment on who holds Oregon's driver's licenses?
Chairman Pearson, Senator Whitson, let me defer to Tom McClellan on that.
Chair McClellan.
McPherson. Tom McClellan, Acting DMV Administrator. That includes student drivers, those who have permits as well. So anyone 15, basically, and older would be eligible. So those are all the licenses that we have on record, active licenses, or within a year of being expired. So it's a number we've got. It's just it's a calculation from the computer of how many we have on file.
Can I pull up on this a second? Is it possible that could be skewed by a person having two licenses, a regular driver's license and a commercial license or something like that?
It may include some commercial driver licensing in addition to the Class C regular licenses. That is possible. That is possible.
Thank you.
And Mr. McClellan, did you have any remarks other than the response to that question?
No, the zebra sticker program, I would like to give you an overview of that. Seems okay. To be some interest in that.
I would say go ahead, Mr. Chairman, before us.
Good
Chair, members of the committee. Again, Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator. Just as an overview, in 1989, the legislature approved a pilot program we called it the Zebra Sticker Program, that was implemented on a four-year pilot basis, starting in January of 1990. It's House Bill 2744. It required police, law enforcement, to confiscate vehicle registration cards from the vehicles, from the owners, and to mark your registration plates when citing or arresting drivers for certain traffic offenses. The offenses included a felony driving while suspended for a violation of the financial responsibility law, the insurance law, and for driving without a valid driver's license. This became known as the Zebra Sticker Law because of the striped stickers, the black and white stickers that were affixed to the plates. The law was allowed to sunset in 1994, so it existed for four calendar years. How the law worked, the Zebra Sticker Law was designed to discourage unlicensed driving by providing DMV with the authority to cancel the registration of a vehicle that was operated by a suspended driver. The apprehending police officer would immediately take possession of the vehicle registration and provide that operator with a temporary 60-day registration. The officer then mailed the registration to DMV, where the vehicle's registration would be canceled within 60 days if the owner did not take action to clear the underlying issue. The officer also placed a striped sticker on the annual renewal sticker on the vehicle license plate. This marking gave police probable cause to stop the vehicle in the future and to determine if the vehicle was properly licensed. The legal owner of the vehicle could clear the vehicle registration status by paying a small fee and purchasing new renewal stickers, but only if that person had a valid driver's license. Stickers were placed on approximately 31,000 vehicles each year, of which around 56% of those were owned by the offender. There were two independent evaluations done of the program. In 1993, after the program had in effect almost 3.5 years, DMV conducted a study. There was also one done a few years later in 1997, which looked at Oregon and Washington statistics. It was done by the National Public Services Research Institute. Attached is a brief summary of those two reports to my testimony, done by Arnie Jones, who was actually the researcher at DMV in 1993. The DMV study was based on three sources of information, including an analysis of DMV data, a survey of 512 police officers, and a statistical analysis of DMV records, comparing the unlicensed drivers before and after the implementation of the Zebra Sticker Law. The DMV study found the following. First, the driver was not the owner of the vehicle in approximately 44% of the cases. That's the family situation that was described earlier. Second, most police officers thought it was a useful and effective law because it caused inconvenience for the driver of sticker vehicles and helped police identify unlicensed and suspended drivers. However, they also felt that the law was easy to circumvent, primarily because of the scraping of the stickers by individuals. It was not very effective in actually taking suspended drivers off the road. The DMV records analysis revealed that sticker drivers were not more likely to become reinstated or to be licensed, which was one of the purposes of the program, and that only sticker drivers who were suspended for financial responsibility violations actually had fewer subsequent traffic accidents and convictions than a comparable group cited that were not stickered prior to 1989. And the other study that was conducted and released in 1997, it evaluated the impact of the law on high-risk drivers who were suspended for DUII. Their analysis showed fewer subsequent moving violations and accidents for those DUI drivers who were stickered under the Zebra Sticker Law, compared to those who were given a driving while suspended citation only. An analysis conducted over time revealed a general reduction in moving violation and accident rates of suspended DUI drivers that corresponded with the Zebra Sticker Law being in effect. This suggests that a general deterrent effect may have resulted in Oregon from the Zebra Sticker Law. The study did indicate that they did not find any measurable effect in the Washington sample they looked at. So in summary, in general, both studies found that reductions in violations and or crashes resulted from the Zebra Sticker program. The Oregon study found some corroborating evidence for effectiveness of the program and the underlying reasons for effectiveness in the opinions and the perceptions of law enforcement predominantly. There were some issues identified, such as the fact that in almost half of the cases, the driver was not the owner of the vehicle. The study also determined that suspicious drivers were not more likely to become reinstated, and that the program was not always effective in taking suspended drivers off the road. It should also be noted that the program was not without cost, as it was necessary for DMV to establish a special unit to administer the program. Positions were also added in field offices. I believe it was about a 23-position impact in 1990, and they were spending between $1 million and $1.5 million per biennium 15, 16 years ago. So approximately that would be the fiscal impact. We have not done a more recent fiscal impact on this proposal.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. Questions? Mr. Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand, the program sunsetted in 94, and then a subsequent study looking at the data from 97 showed that it was particularly effective on DUII offenders.
Yes, that is true, Mr. Chair. Representative Shields.
Okay.
This was a four-year program, so January of 1990, running for 4 years. So ran through the end of 1993.
Let's see. Was anybody around in 1997? Do you remember any discussion, Senator Przanski, around this?
It's so much of a deja vu because, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff that the two work groups have come up with, we've actually implemented, and we found out for resource reasons it just couldn't be done. I mean, we actually were sending out letters to the registered owners of the vehicle saying, if you allow this person that you who was caught driving your vehicle is suspended, you're now on notice. If you allow this person to drive your vehicle in the future while they're suspended, we're taking your vehicle. And so that's one of the alternatives we've heard, but it's very, very resource driven. Mm-hmm. As that, we do the research, send out letters, certified mail, return receipt, all this, and then categorizing all that. But yeah, I mean, what I remember from the Zebra program as a prosecutor, and then also when after being elected in 95, is that there was mixed opinions of it depending on who you talk to. Mm-hmm.
Any further questions of Mr. McClellan? And thank you very much, gentlemen. Now, Judge Tuttle, you've been very patient about getting some of the other material being taken out of turn, so let's hear from you.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Co-Chairs Przanski and McPherson, and all members of this honorable committee. For the record, my name is Steve Todd. I'm the Pro Tem Circuit Court Judge in Multnomah County. I'm very pleased to be here today, and I want to especially thank Bill Taylor for requesting input from judges. We very much respect the work that you do, but we also want to let you know how things work in the real world, and so we're always happy to share with you our experiences of how things work out. There are three words that every judge hates to hear, and me too, and those words are, I'll be brief. I'm going to try and be brief to leave time for questions, but there are some things I do want to tell you. I've spoken with a lot of judges about this topic over the years, and there's not a lot of consensus. Municipal judges, JPs, and circuit judges have different perspectives about this, and even in the same court in the same county, we have a lot of different opinions. It's not my role to speak for the Oregon Judicial Department or for any other judge, just to give you my own experience. My experience is extensive. I've probably handled thousands of these cases, either as a court clerk, as a deputy district attorney that prosecuted hundreds of these for about 13 years, and then I've been a traffic judge for about 10 years. And I can tell you there's no easy solutions. Part of the problem is that Oregonians review driving as a right, not a privilege. And they rarely accept that anyone can take that away. Even when mass transit is available, driving is basically a necessity for a lot of people that we see in court. And so they feel caught between a rock and a hard place in many situations. I can tell you, regardless of what laws we enact or what penalties there might be in the impact, really is how they're implemented. Not what the potential penalty might be, but what really happens in the real world. I can tell you, frankly, the higher fines, the prospect of jail, will not discourage most drivers. What will discourage them is having their car towed and being in custody, even if it's only a matter of hours. That seems to have a greater impact among the people I see than the potential of going to jail a year in the future when the case finally goes through the system, or having a fine that might never have to pay. The reason is that drivers are suspended can vary quite a bit, and I encourage you to take that into account. And I appreciate Representative Flores has taken that into account in her committee. But we see the financial problem cases, and then we see the habitual bad drivers, and it's a mistake to lump them in the same group. What I see frequently is these violation-level offenders, and it's a vicious financial cycle that gets them into court and gets them into trouble. Frequently, a ticket for driving while suspended will be a $427 fine. A lot of these folks don't go to court. They don't see the point in doing that. And so they frequently end up having to pay the whole fine, although they'll never pay that. They get suspended for not paying that fine. And then they get another driving while suspended ticket, and the cycle starts. I frequently see people in court that owe several $1,000, and they tell me, frankly, there's no point in paying off their other fines. There's no point in buying insurance. There's no point in following the law because it's much cheaper to buy a car every 6 months or so, planning to be towed, planning on getting another ticket, and planning on avoiding the entire system. In terms of solutions, I would encourage you to look very carefully at issues of traffic safety, not just at cracking down and driving while suspended. You really want to focus on habitual offenders that can kill or injure people, not necessarily on people that are otherwise driving safely but just have financial problems. I've noticed a big increase in hit and run cases, and I think the reason why is we have more and more people driving without insurance or without a license, and that increases their incentive to flee the scene of an accident. In terms of solutions, I can see about five here, and I'll briefly touch on what I know about those, and then I'll be open for questions. The first one you already heard about, which is making it easier for people to get their license back. It's usually people with financial problems. In our county, we call it Clean Slate, where people are allowed to do community service work. It's almost like a drug court model where people see the judge frequently and have a chance to work off their fines. There's a problem with doing that, and that's revised statute 153.093. I'll talk about that in a minute. That makes it difficult for a court to do that unless the prosecution and police agree to dismiss or reduce charges after the fact. But the clean slot model is good for the community. It's fair to the offenders because they have to do something. They can't just get all their fines wiped out. They have to do community service work, and it works out well. It also helps us have some credibility as a system because we can tell people, you can work off your fines. There's no excuse for not doing something to take care of your business. The second issue is prosecution discretion, and I think that's a big area here. This is all resource-driven, and it's really up to the police and the prosecution to decide what to prosecute, who to prosecute, what degree of charge they want to bring to court, and whether or not they want to reduce it later or dismiss it later, because there's a lot going on in this area. Regardless of what you implement as a statute, a lot of these things are reduced or dismissed later, as you heard from Senator Przanski. What I frequently see in traffic court is the police try and work with the driver and with me as a judge. They frequently will agree to set over a case on the condition that the driver gets their license back or pays off a different fine or gets caught up in child support. And when they come back to court, if they've done those things, the officers sometimes will agree to dismiss a case. And one of the reasons they do that is they know as a judge I can't reduce the fine more than 25%. So we're actually having people getting cases dismissed when they really should be paying the fine, they should be having a conviction. But the officer feels the best solution is to offer that dismissal because then the judge's hands are tied. I think the DA and prosecution actually have some things they can do. They can focus on frequent flyers almost better than the legislature can. They have the option of charging many of these people with misdemeanors or even felonies right up front and focusing on particular drivers rather than choosing that as a group. The next solution I see is criminalizing driving while suspended. I know you've been talking about three strikes and that sort of thing. The judges I've talked to are really concerned about that in terms of resources. The cost of appointing an attorney in these cases is between $200 and $400. Even if they only do a few hours work on the case, it's very, very expensive. What we see in our court frequently is the DA will offer at the time of arraignment that if the defendant agrees to a $1,000 fine and no jail and no probation, that the case can be settled right then and there. And so that frequently happens when someone's suspended for a breath test or a driving under influence conviction. So we see some of those cases settled without the high costs involved. But nonetheless, if they are charged as a misdemeanor, the person does have a right to court-appointed counsel. There's certainly police overtime involved. The more court appearances you have, the more likely the officers are going to be involved. For example, if you made a case into a felony instead of a misdemeanor, you automatically are going to add several hundred dollars of cost to the case because we have to have a grand jury proceeding. The officer has to parent that. The other problem, I think, is a big one, which is collateral attacks on prior convictions. We went through this back in the 80s. I remember how much that cost and what a problem it was. Brown versus Multnomah County, we used to have violation or infraction level DUII, and then based on the number of priors, you could get a misdemeanor DUII. But of course, the defense lawyers are going to go back and look at those prior convictions, even at the violation level, and collaterally attack them. So we end up relitigating cases many, many years later. So criminalizing driving while suspended could cause a big cost increase if those cases really go through the system as misdemeanors. The fourth thing I see is the issue about fine reductions. That may sound counterintuitive to you, but most of the people I see in court would like to be legal, would like to pay fines, but it's just out of their price range. Under the prior law, I could reduce a fine up to 50% if someone did something that I ordered them to do. So, for example, a $427 ticket, I could knock off $200 if they got their license back within a reasonable amount of time. Now I don't have that option. I could only reduce the fine about $100. And most of these people that already are in trouble, $2,000 or $3,000 with some other judge, are not inclined to go get their license. ORS 153.093 was enacted in 2003. And I think one reason for that was revenue generation. By restricting judges' ability to reduce fines, the legislature had hoped that we would collect a lot more revenue. I used to joke with my colleagues that I was personally responsible for the budget deficit because the legislature was just looking at all the fines I imposed, not how much I actually collected. Imposing these fines was not necessarily getting us anywhere. In fact, we encouraged people to not pay them. They were so high, they figured, why pay them at all? We see a lot of offenders that just choose to keep on driving rather than trying to do it the right way because it's just beyond their reach. I can see you changing that law if you wanted us to work with drivers more carefully in getting the licenses back. You could give the judges authority to reduce or suspend fines, but only for certain conditions. I think judges up until 2003 were reducing fines for no real good reason. But you could say we could reduce fines for people that do community service work, for people that complete traffic schools, for people that pay their other fines in other courts, people that pay their child support, people that go through alcohol and drug treatment, people that get their license back, or even somebody who didn't get any new tickets for a period of months. If we had some discretion in that area, we can work with drivers. As I told you, I frequently will do this if the officer agrees that we can set over a case and give a person a chance to pay off their tickets in other jurisdictions or get their child support back up to speed. And then the officer will voluntarily dismiss the case because that's the interest of justice. The last thing, of course, is what you've been talking about in terms of seizing vehicles or plates. My recollection of the Zebra program is it did not work well. It was very expensive and inefficient, and the drivers figured out many ways to get around that. Impounding vehicles is an option were it not for the concerns about forfeiture. Bill Taylor is absolutely correct in what he says about us having some problems under the Oregon Constitution with outright forfeiture. But keep in mind these cars are cheap, and so you don't necessarily need to forfeit. What happens is they're towing a $500 car, $200 tow bill. Many drivers just never get their car back anyway. You're not seeing Mercedes towed for driving while suspended. In terms of seizing plates, I can see some practical problems of just getting the rusty plates off the rusty old cars, but that might be an option of actually taking the plates so the police can see from a distance whether the car is legal. Booting would be an idea, except that it may create traffic hazards because these cars are not in somebody's driveway or the side of the road. That's a big traffic problem. I wish I could say more, but I know your time's already over. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Brzezinski. The court you're with, is it Marion or Multnomah?
Multnomah County Circuit Court.
Do they use any type of collection agencies to try to collect on outstanding fines?
We refer to the Department of Revenue.
So you use the department?
Yes.
And has there been any discussion? I'm just curious because our court uses private collectors to, after they've gone through a certain process or stage, that they'll ship it over. Of course, we lose revenue that way because they're going to take a bigger chunk, but I'm just wondering if there's been any success in a larger scale.
Chair McPherson, Chair Brzezinski, I believe our court primarily uses Department of Revenue, but I have heard of people being contacted by a collection agency, so I'm not sure if they go through DOR first or directly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment. Thank you, Judge Todd. I very much appreciated your list of possible solutions. I think we very much parallel the discussions that we had. And in regard to the constitutional question as a result of Brown v. Multnomah County, talking with legislative counsel, criminal defense lawyers, and DAs, we think there might be a way to craft language that would address that issue or stay clear of the issue, similar to what the Bike Users Alliance had done in their legislation. But we're not there with any specific language, but we think we might be able to get there. If I recall our conversations, Anne, maybe.
Chairman, as a community representative, Flores, you're right. I mean, Brown versus Multnomah County is an issue. Back in 1976, the courts found where they had a statute, said the first time was an infraction, a violation for driving under the influence. The second time it was a crime. The courts looked at everything surrounding the fact that the person could be arrested and taken in custody at the time, $1,000 fine, and said it had all the indicia of a crime, and therefore you had to appoint counsel to get to the second time. You had to appoint counsel on all the prior ones. I think what the judge is pointing out, the fact is that if we had a law like that, defense attorney would be going back and attacking collaterally the earlier violations on the grounds, for example, that there was no counsel involved, or there was something wrong with the record. And what I also understand is that there's a problem in many of the Justice of the Peace courts and municipal courts with the issue of record.
There's
very little record, so it's impossible to tell what went on at the time. And my assumption is they'd be attacking the lack of a credible record to then prove your second step.
Right.
Well, I mean, the reality, it's on the prosecutor's obligation to actually prove that it was a valid conviction, and where you do have courts that aren't of record, which are virtually every municipal court with the exception of, I guess, Lake Oswego and a couple others that have now taken advantage of something we passed 4 or 5 years back, that you are going to be challenged to get any type of records, because a lot of the courts, if they have paper record, they will dispose of those records after the retention time is passed. And
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. And of course, we have out-of-state convictions from Vancouver or farther north.
Yeah.
If I could mention one other thing, Mr. Chair. One option that the prosecutors frequently do have that they have not taken advantage of in this area is to reduce the charge to a violation at the time of arraignment. So it's not a misdemeanor requiring the counsel be appointed. For example, if a DWS driver were arrested and spent the night in jail, saw the judge the next day, the prosecutor could immediately reduce the charge to a violation, and you get the best of both worlds, because they've had a sanction, they've had their car towed, but all they're looking now is a fine. And so we've done that in other areas, criminal trespass, drug-free zone cases in Portland frequently were handled that way, where it was reduced as a violation so you didn't have to appoint counsel.
Chairman, Judge, you're saying that, for example, if we made all of the driving while suspended a crime like it was in 1987,
yes.
That was the first bill I ever handled, by the way, and then allowed the judge or whomever to reduce it to a violation, then you would not have to appoint counsel, but you could put the person in jail.
That's correct.
But if the judge did not reduce the violation, you'd have to appoint counsel.
Yes, that's correct. And that could be the prosecution making that decision rather than the judge.
Right.
Okay.
But yes, that's absolutely correct.
Any further questions for Judge Todd?
Just a comment, Representative McPherson. I wanted to let you know how much we appreciate it. Your testimony, all too often we have, you know, the district attorneys on one side, the criminal defense lawyers on the other side, and it's very helpful to have the judiciary involved in helping us craft these bills, too. And that would encourage us to have more of that.
We're happy to come in any traffic safety issues. We're happy to come back. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. And the last individual we have here is Jeff Leahy from the trooper from the Peace Officers Association.
Co-Chairman Pozanski, McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Leahy. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I've also been a trooper. I'm a senior trooper with the Oregon State Police for the last 21 years. 15 of that has been on patrol. A couple of things I'd like to thank you all for looking into this. This is a subject that we've been dealing with for quite some time since I've been a trooper. Although we have some recent public outrage, we've been outraged about this for quite a long time. I'd also like to really thank Judge Todd. I think he has a real handle on this problem, and he sounds like to me it's something he needs to be listened to. I would like to say that I pulled my members, and one of the things that they wholly support is this clean slate program. By and large, the people that are involved with the driving while suspended issues are first-time offenders or administrative suspensions, and if they just had some direction on how to correct the suspensions, get their licenses back, pay off their fines. A lot of them just don't go through with the program because they just don't know where to go. They leave court shaking their head, and they need direction. And the program, as it was explained to me, sounded like it was a really good thing in Multnomah County. One of the things I wanted to briefly talk about was the zebra sticker program. I was around during that time, and I was involved when it started. I was involved when it stopped. And at the time, of course, we all thought it was a great deal because, quite frankly, we couldn't do anything else. We couldn't tow their cars back then. But the zebra sticker program came about, and we thought we had this great tool. I guess effective in some ways, but in more ways, all it did was help us stop these people to give them another DWS citation that they weren't going to pay. The real downside to the zebra sticker program is that it created a whole cottage industry for stolen stickers. I brought a visual aid here so that I might prove it here. One of the easiest ways to take care of the zebra sticker program was to go out and get a license plate, and this one is Representative Krieger's front plate. I walk up to it at night in your driveway, and I take it off just like this. Now I've got your sticker. You've got your license plate. You may discover it. You probably won't until you're stopped. And I've got your sticker, and that's now on my car. You have to go down and now purchase two new license plates. And there was a lot of that going on in Coos Bay where I was there. I mean, when we first started the sticker program, we descended upon the suspended drivers like locusts. Zebra stickers were everywhere. Not 2 weeks later, the phone was ringing off the hook about my stolen license plates or my stolen stickers. They weren't putting the license plates back on the car. They were just taking the stickers. We have an impound law, Senate Bill 780. In some areas of the state, it's not used as much as it is over here, but it's an option that we have. It's an option that we use. To enhance that, perhaps, maybe there should be an option that we could seize the plates if we deem it necessary. By and large, if you're talking about a tier level of suspended drivers, and it's tier one, the low levels are not our big problem. By and large, I think if they had the opportunity to go get their license back and direction to do so, I think that they would. The tier two and three, the higher level of offenders, it doesn't matter what label you put on them. Habitual offenders, criminal, they're not going to care. They're going to be driving, and there has to be a way that we remove them from their vehicle. Senate Bill 780 tows are very helpful. I think being able to seize a plate would help a great deal as well. Like I said, the members of my organization, the troopers at large, are very, very thankful that this is being looked into, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Trooper Woody. Any questions?
Thank you, Chair. There's no question, but Trooper Reedy is a tribute to his mother and her teaching abilities for showing visual effects.
Visual aids.
Visual aids, yes.
Yeah,
appreciate that.
Any further questions? Well, if not, then thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Council Taylor, I believe that these were all the presenters we were expecting on the driving
license. That's correct, Mr. Chair. But if I could add one thing. What I did when this came up, I learned the numbers from DMV and the courts of about 20 high flyers. And one interesting thing about them is they don't bother to show up in court. And that is a Class A misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. So the high flyers, there are many ways of getting them. One would be that. Other The judge mentioned the fact that the police have a lot of discretion in how they charge and how they prosecute. And I think the bottom line on a lot of this, it's resources.
Okay, that concludes our information portion on driving while suspended. We next had scheduled for the hour from 2 to 3 presentation on substance abuse problems in our criminal justice system, and it's my intention to go forward with that now. We are expecting Attorney General Hardy Myers and the Deputy Pete Shepard at about 3 o'clock, so we'll probably break to have a presentation from them when they arrive and then resume the remainder of the substance abuse presentation. And I have a number of names here that were given to me by counsel, and the first of those is Ginger Martin from the Department of Corrections. Ms. Martin, should you be leading off? Is this the right order to take things in? Okay.
I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director responsible for Transitional Services with the Department of Corrections. And I'm here today with my colleagues from Community Corrections to talk about drug problems and property crime in corrections populations in Oregon today. The mission of the Department of Corrections is to hold offenders accountable for their actions and to reduce the risk of future criminal behavior. In order to help us know how to do that, we assess each offender who comes into prison for their criminal risk factors. And when we do that, we find that two-thirds of the men and more than 80% of the women who come to prison have a criminal risk factor associated with alcohol and drug abuse. When offenders do recidivate after they leave us, only 43% of those recidivating crimes are drug crimes. The theft is the second most common recidivating offense at 11.5%. You can see in the pie graphs in your handout that the prison population looks quite different than the population on supervision in the community in terms of drug crimes and property crimes. So in prison, we're looking at about a quarter of our population in prison due to a property or a drug crime. In the community, and this could be either someone on felony probation or on post-prison supervision, 61% of that group are on supervision for either a drug crime or a property crime. In terms of the treatment that's available in the prison system, we have a treatment capacity in Oregon Department of Corrections prisons right now of 461 beds. These programs are all intensive residential treatment programs, with the exception of a very small day treatment program that is a Spanish language program. They all use evidence-based cognitive behavioral curricula. So we are prioritizing those offenders who have the highest risk to reoffend due to their addiction and have the most serious alcohol and drug problems in the treatment beds that we have. We know that about three-quarters of the people who come to prison have an alcohol and drug problem, but we're really looking for the people with the most serious problem. And about two-thirds of our group have serious problems with addiction. If we look specifically at the property crime offenders who have a severe problem or addiction, we find that 71% of that group is coming to us with a very serious alcohol and drug problem. We are currently, with the treatment capacity we have available to us now, we're currently able to reach about half of those offenders who are, again, most likely to reoffend and who also have a criminal risk factor associated with addiction. So we have, by our estimates today, approximately 400 beds needed capacity that we don't have. So we have about 460 beds in order to meet our current capacity, and just to deal with that highest risk group, we would need an additional 400 beds. So obviously we need to have a good link to community corrections and post-prison supervision programs, because some people are going to be leaving prison without the treatment that they need. And those who receive treatment will need continuing care so that they can be stable and continue in their course of recovery when they leave us. costs for prison-based treatment today, about $33, $34 per day for the treatment part. And again, this is an intensive residential treatment type of methodology. The total invested in alcohol and drug treatment in our prison programs is $11.5 million for this biennium. In community corrections, as you know, this is a function of state government, but it's operated in partnership with local county-operated community corrections agencies. And so each agency plans the balance of supervision, of community-based sanctions, and of correctional intervention programs that they want to put in place in their community. In 2005-2007, about $6 million of state general fund was invested in alcohol and drug treatment programs in the community. And in this biennium, with the increases in funding to community corrections, we're seeing an investment of $9 million of state general fund in alcohol and drug treatment programs in community corrections agencies. Community corrections is funded in a case rate or a bundled rate kind of format. So we send dollars out to counties that are meant to pay for both supervision services and sanctions. And the rates that are our current rates are $8 per head per day for those on probation, and about $12 per head per day for those people who originally came to a prison and are now on supervision in the community. Looking again at what capacity we need for people in the community who have serious alcohol and drug problems, today there are about 77,700 offenders on supervision who are high or medium risk to offend and are on supervision for a drug crime. There are an additional 3,500 who are high and medium risk to offend and are on supervision today for a property crime. And we know, again, the majority of those people do have serious addiction problems. So that leaves us with about a needed treatment capacity of around 10,000 based on our current populations. I've included in your packet some information about what works to reduce reoffending, taken completely from Washington. The Washington State Institute for Public Policy has done probably the most recent intensive meta-analysis of various kinds of correctional interventions to tell us what is working to reduce recidivism. So I summarized those programs that the Institute found were effective in reducing recidivism and might be applicable to a property offender group. They found that community drug treatment was one of the highest types of treatments, deliveries that reduced recidivism the most. I didn't say that very elegantly, but that was one of the best types of interventions in terms of reducing recidivism. The highest reductions in recidivism were found with intensive supervision programs that had a treatment-oriented approach. So they were more than just monitoring and catching people in violations. They were close monitoring tied closely with the treatment or intervention program. The last thing that I wanted to share with you today in terms of how our system is currently managing folks on supervision, drug addicts, property offenders, is our administrative sanctioning program. This allows the probation parole officer to apply an immediate consequence to offenders on probation and post-prison supervision when they violate a condition of their supervision. It's an important tool in gaining compliance. When the program first started, which was way back in 93, after it had been in operation for about a year, there was an evaluation done. What was found at that time is that offenders who participated in the program had lower rates of recidivism and higher rates of treatment participation when they were involved in this immediate response to violations, as opposed to the old practice where you might save up a number of violations, you eventually go to court and talk to the judge. Long time passes, it's not a good way to impact behavior. One particular example of swift and sure consequences that change behavior, a number of jurisdictions around the state from time to time have implemented a swift and sure response to a positive urinalysis, and when jurisdictions are able to do that. Some of that depends on jail bed capacity, of course. When a short jail sanction is imposed with each positive urinalysis, you do find a pretty quick and dramatic drop in the incidence of positive urinalysis. That's not a whole program, but it's an example of the ability to use a sanction to deal with a violation. If you're going to get a long-term change, obviously you need to have that person also in an addictions treatment program, but it's a good companion to get behavior change. That I'm obviously trying to get through this as quickly as possible in the interest of time, but I'm happy to answer any questions or go into any more detail.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, looking at the agenda, I'm not sure who the other presenters are going to be on this, and some of the questions I might ask might be addressed by others. Do you, I see the topics listed, but I don't see the actual presenters.
Yeah.
Do we know who else is?
Yeah, and the other presenters that I have on my list here are Steve Berger from Klamath County Community Corrections, Kiki Parker-Rose from Klamath County Community Corrections, Mark Rasmussen from Clackamas County Community Corrections, Devarshi Bajpai, and Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks.
I have a question, Mr. Christian. We have business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Martin, I've been on the bandwagon since I've got in this building about the fact that when I learned that we had a problem with prisoners coming out who'd been treated and they lose their treatment, their medication for 90 days till they go on the Oregon Health Plan. Have we straightened that out, and is that being accomplished now that those inmates that are on medications get those medications until they're in the Oregon Health Plan?
Co-Chairs, Representative Wisman, people who are taking psychotropic medications when they are released from prison leave prison with a 30-day medication supply. That may or may not get them to the next appointment. So I don't think we've solved the problem completely. We are trying to identify people when they're in prison who are eligible for federal benefits and get that process in place so that they can quickly get onto Medicare and Medicaid when they once they leave. So they do go out with some work done on qualifying for benefits that they might be eligible for and that 30-day medication supply.
Mr. Chair, I'm disappointed in that because I think the corrections and DHS need to solve that problem. I mean, you're the experts. You know that those people, if they're not on their medications, their chance to recommit crime is very high. So I don't understand why we can't work this problem. I've known about it for three interims. So it looks like DHS and the corrections could get this solved because it's what you're telling us is it's not solved.
Representative Krieger.
This is from Washington, and so at the bottom it says what works to reduce reoffending, work and educational programs. There's four of them listed there. Are we doing all four of those? And to what degree? And who receives it? And we've got this total population. I would suspect we're not.
Co-Chairs, Representative Krieger, we do actually offer all of these types of intervention in prisons today. I don't have with me the information about the percentage of need met. We certainly have that available. I didn't anticipate that for today.
Mr. Chair, I'd really like to know that Representative Shields and I talked earlier today about job opportunity and housing along with the recovery program after release, and that the recidivism rate drops down. And I don't see us emphasizing that, and if that's what keeps people from going back in, the combination of these things is going to cost us less than it is to house them when they come back through the system.
And following up on that, there's a program that the Department of Corrections entered into in the early 90s with sponsors out of Eugene. It was one that Representative Krieger's comment mentioning that I'd like to actually get that study or the results of that. My understanding is that 29 or 30 individuals that were not hand-selected, that were just taken out of the general population, they went in for an intensive oversight, supervision, housing, and then they actually kept up with their drug treatment, getting them jobs, having housing, and only one of those people reoffended in a year. And I mean, that's the type of results I think we're looking for. And I'd like to get, let's say, pull that off the shelf and let's look at that and see why we haven't pursued that type of approach, knowing the cost to the system if we have these people continue to reoffend. And the other thing, I think, with Representative Wisnett had said, I've got an individual that basically called me up, and I know that they were completely taken off the health plan because they were incarcerated, and they have to go back and reapply to get in. And the reality, we've cut the program so they can't get back on the program.
Yep.
And so they're completely out. And it's one of those things that it seems to me we need to move to a system that we suspend, and then when they come out, they are actually able to get back or continue on what they had and not bump them off the program to the point of where they're now causing more crime and more victims because they're not getting the care they need.
Thank you, Chairman Christian. Ms. Martin, do we have any way to estimate the number of drug-related property offenders who are not incarcerated and receive no treatment due to current space and funding constraints?
Senator Woodset, I would ask that my colleagues from Community Corrections try and address that question. I can tell you how many offenders need treatment. I don't have data on how many offenders are actually getting the treatment that they need, but I think my colleagues who will be coming up here after would have some notion of how able they are to get people the treatment that they need.
Thank you. I'll ask them.
Representative Cameron, just a clarification, Senator. I thought we passed in 05, we passed a bill that would allow when somebody goes into prison that was suspended and then they come back out and they go right back. Does somebody here know about that?
Yeah, I'd like to have that on the record because what I've been told is
that
very limited to people like women who have children or pregnancy, that it's not the general population. If that's not the case, then my office is not getting the right information from DLC.
Good question to have a draft bill.
Okay.
Coaches, I could actually address that. The problem with the suspend statute is that it works for people when they're incarcerated for a year or less. Because people come to prison generally are with us for more than a year, the federal benefits are eliminated because of, I'm not sure exactly what happens, but the federal benefits are tied to another benefit that ends after a year. And so they don't suspend. I suspect that might be something that could be changed with a change in state policy. And I'm hoping that the Governor's Reentry Council, which will be meeting for the first time next week, that group is called together to take a look at some of these system problems and barriers that we have in place that we can actually have the power to change in Oregon. So, and that will certainly be one of those issues that we'll be looking at.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Martin. Let's move forward and invite up Steve Berger and Kiki Parker-Rose. Would it make sense for Mark Rasmussen from the Clackamas County Community Corrections to come up at the same time? Would that be logical?
Good afternoon. My name is Kiki Parker-Rose, and I'm a field supervisor for the Klamath Lake County Community Corrections Office. Thank you for allowing me to come before you today to discuss the process that a offender goes through once they come to community corrections. Once an offender is sentenced to supervision by the releasing authority, which is either the court, the local supervisory authority, or the parole board, it is our responsibility as community corrections officers to hold the offender accountable, plus change the offender's behavior. I'd like to walk you through this process. Parole and probation receives the offender under supervision and outlines to the offenders the rules and requirements for them while under supervision. These rules and expectations are provided for in both the general conditions of probation found in the Oregon Revised Statutes and the special conditions as ordered by the releasing authority. Parole and probation officers complete an intake, which includes gathering general information like name and address, as well as more specific information such as the relationship with the family, the alcohol and drug issues, employment and educational experiences, housing, which is oftentimes challenging, mental and physical health, attitudes, and associates. All of these factors that I just mentioned are known as the criminogenic risk factors, those factors that contribute to criminal behavior. Further, we complete a risk assessment which establishes the level of supervision we will provide for each offender. During the intake process, we find most offenders relay the only problem that they have in their lives right now is us, the parole and probation officer. They don't recognize that alcohol and drug issues have impacted their lives negatively. And we call that lack of problem recognition the pre-contemplation stage of change. Once we complete the assessment, we work together with the offender to create a case plan that will assist them in learning how to change their behaviors. At the same time, we are requiring them to be compliant with the terms and conditions of their supervision. We have learned that we must talk with the offender and not to the offender. We must gain buy-in in this process from their perspective. We must let them take ownership of the changes that he or she needs to make in order to be successful. Once the offender begins to recognize the fact that they do have a problem that is interfering with their life, we know we're making progress. We're moving the offender from one stage of change to another. If we can move them from the contemplation stage of change, where they recognize that they actually have a problem, where they're willing to make changes in their own life, then we make a referral as parole and probation officers. Sometimes this process of moving the offender from pre-contemplation to the preparation stage can take a few months. Other times it can take a matter of weeks. Once the offender is ready to engage in treatment services, preparation, it is our job to ensure the referral is made. Herein lies the challenge. The offender is ready to change. The PO has made the referral. However, the offender is not able to engage in appropriate services because the offender does not have adequate funding for an assessment or to complete an orientation. The treatment program is available in the community, yet without the appropriate funding to enroll financially, there is a barrier. This lack of resource interferes with our ability to move forward with our case plans. As a line officer, we've recognized the need. We've developed the case plan with the offender. The offender actually recognizes that they have a problem. We are ready to meet the offender where they're at, responsivity, but they cannot access needed services. In Klamath County, we contract for several treatment services, yet even with these contracts in place and a strong working relationship with our local providers, many offenders are not able to access services because they simply cannot pay the assessment or upfront orientation fee. It is our experience that treatment combined with supervision does work, and our co-case management style of treating offenders is effective. Our outcomes in Klamath County have been very positive. Parole and probation officers are doing a very good job in providing supervision to offenders in the community. However, we can do a better job and appropriately implement evidence-based practices if we can effectively obtain services from the providers. This can be obtained by additional funding to our partners so that they can provide services to the offender population. Simply put, as parole and probation officers, we can identify risk factors, make referrals to address the risk factors, but if offenders are unable to access services, then we will not be able to assist offenders with the change process. Thus, the offender will likely continue to commit crime. Thank you.
Thank you. I thought we'd hear from all three of them in the panel and then open up the questions.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Steve Berger, president of Oregon Association of Community Correction Directors and the director of Klamath and Lake Counties Community Correction. As you just heard, Kiki Parker-Rhodes, field supervisor, gave you an overview of a line officer and the resources and the process that they go through working with offenders. And Ginger Martin also provided a very broad overview of Department of Corrections, the prison population, and mentioned community corrections. In the interest of time, I did submit written testimony, so I will try to go through that and highlight some points that I think, at least that I would like to emphasize. I guess to start with, to emphasize what Ginger started around community corrections, I think we have a very successful model here in Oregon with the partnership between the state and the counties. And within the counties, we also have a very strong infrastructure with what I believe is necessary for us to be successful. We have strong community partners working with the criminal offender population, and we are successful in that endeavor, recognizing that over 90% of the offenders in prison ultimately return to the community correction, return to the community, and that community corrections currently manage over 35,000 felony offenders. I need to note that the majority of those offenders do not commit another felony crime. Over 70% of those in supervision do not recidivate. They do not commit another felony. When you compare the cost of community supervision between $7 and $12 a day with the jail costs, with a state average of about $105 per day, and a state prison cost of $78 a day, community corrections is a successful and cost-effective model. Within community corrections, we're now capable of monitoring our success through a new web-based corrections management information system. This system has been available for over a year now and is a web-based model that allows us to follow our progress and follow how we're doing on our benchmarks on a day-to-day basis. This is consistent. This allows us to be proactive in what my experience shows agencies are generally performed to what is inspected rather than what is expected. The current model in place to evaluate our performance is based upon reducing criminal behavior, as indicated by recidivism, enforcing court and board orders, as indicated by positive case closures, assisting offenders to change, as indicated by employment rates and treatment participation, and reparation to victims, as indicated by restitution collections. In the testimony, you have a snapshot of Klamath and Lake, which was taken October 10th. That shows you a little bit of the model. Generally, that is in color when you look at it on the web-based. And one thing I would like to probably emphasize as I'm from Klamath and Lake County is that this model shows, although it's in black and white, the green dots aren't. Those are all green dots referencing Klamath and Lake. The importance of that is referencing how we monitor or how we assess this model. It's a simple red light, green light, yellow light model, similar to a traffic signal. Red light indicates that you're below the state baseline by about 5%. Yellow light indicates that you're within 5% of the baseline, and a green light indicates that you're exceeding the state baseline and you're at a higher percentage. As far as resources and funding, during the 2007 session, the legislature adopted a new model for funding community corrections based upon an actual cost study. This model established a simple per-offender cost for supervision, services, and sanctions necessary to manage probation and parole cases. The actual cost study model better reflects the true cost of providing community correction services and did result in an 18% increase in funding. At risk, however, is the increasing pressure for community corrections to mitigate funding cuts in other areas such as Oregon Health Plan, alcohol and drug treatment, and mental health services within the community. I believe the strength of our collaborative partnerships in the community is a major component of our success in community corrections. It takes a multidisciplinary approach to be successful with this challenging population. However, our community partners in the alcohol and drug field have not recovered from the cuts that were made during the 2002 special session and the 2003 legislative session. During that time, roughly 1,000 counselors were laid off during the reductions, and there was a loss of 46 residential beds for alcohol for adults statewide. There was an additional over $8 million in reductions to outpatient treatment through the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program. These losses pose significant challenges for the offenders gaining access to necessary services. As Kiki Parker-Rose noted, we can motivate these offenders and we can assess their needs, but timing is crucial. For an offender population that sometimes struggles on establishing
taking or in taking responsibility on a financial matter, addressing those needs and coming up with those additional $200 and $300 to get into the service sometimes poses a lengthy delay, and some, again, timing is crucial. Sometimes during that 2 to 3 month period while they're on a waiting list for services or that additional money, poses challenges for us supervising that offender. I would also note the fragmented and underfunded community mental health system continues to affect our services. Our clients have very little access to mental health services unless paid for out of our budget or out of the offender's budget. In the 2008 special session, I, as a member of the Community Mental Health Coalition, will be supporting Senator Carter's proposed legislation to require an analysis of the current mental health system in Oregon. I think that will be the foundation for a path to a less fragmented and more efficient system, a system that will keep those with mental illness who have not yet entered the criminal justice system out, yet provides for services for those currently in our correctional facilities once they are released. In closing, I believe the community correction supervision is working in Oregon, and we have made significant progress in reducing recidivism. We have the necessary infrastructure with our community partnerships in place, addressing mental health needs and substance abuse. We just need greater capacity and access for the offender population.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Mr. Rasmussen.
Thank you, Chairman Richardson. Mark Rasmussen, Clackamas County Community Corrections Director. I did not come with a prepared statement, but I would be fascinated to answer some of the questions that came up that you presented to Ms. Martin, and would probably take the time now just to respond to those questions.
Okay, and let's do, in terms of managing our time, we have Attorney General Myers and Deputy Shepherd who have arrived for the 3 o'clock presentation, so if we have, there are going to be much interchange of questions, what we might do is excuse this panel for the moment and go to their presentation and then return to questions. Does that make sense? I see general affirmation. So if you would just step aside here for a few minutes, and then as we go to the next item in our agenda, and then we will return back to take up this important topic.
Chair McPherson, Sheriff Wazowski, members. For the record, my name is Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm joined by Deputy Attorney General Peter Shepherd, and we're pleased to be here in response to the invitation to discuss with the committees the possibility of the February session taking up legislation to implement the two joint resolutions that the regular session referred to the May primary ballot relating to the constitutional rights of crime victims in Oregon. The joint resolutions, as I just mentioned, being referred to the May ballot, create the possibility that if one or both of them are approved by the people, we would, unless there's action at the February session, have a period of several months before the next regular session would be able to address the issue, during which there would be in place no guidance, really, whatsoever for judges, for victims, for prosecutors, for defense counsel, for the criminal justice system as a whole, as to how the effectuation of victims' constitutional rights would be realized, would be carried out. And so what we are hoping is that these committees would endorse, and I presume that would be with legislative leadership support, bringing before the February session a proposed measure that would be made contingent on the approval of one or the other of the ballot measures in May, and which would provide a regime, if you will, for the enforcement and resolution of the issues dealing with possible violation of victims' constitutional rights. The procedural situation right now is this. Exactly like the preparation of the joint resolutions themselves during the regular session, the Department of Justice has undertaken internally, more or less internally, to try to develop a starting proposal. And it would be my intention, Chairman First and Chair Pozanski members, that if the committees endorse bringing this matter before the February session, to complete the process of developing a starting draft of a measure, as we did with the joint resolutions, and then to reconvene a working group, much like that which was convened for the joint resolution process, and have that working group become the sort of a venue within which the starting draft could be vetted, concerns could be raised, and the effort made to arrive at what would be essentially a consensus recommendation to the assembly for the measure. Or if not consensus, at least as close to that as we could get, and with primary points of disagreement identified for the legislature's benefit. That process worked well in bringing before the regular session the joint resolutions themselves, and I think it would have good promise for doing so with respect to the actual implementing measure. One difference, of course, in this phase would be that if there were legislators, particularly, I suppose, from the judiciary committees of the House and the Senate, who wish to be invited into the discussion process, that I would be chairing, if you will, of course, we would welcome that and be guided entirely by your wish on that. That would be, of course, entirely up to the Assembly. But that's essentially how I would propose to go forward with the development of the measure if it's endorsed as a subject matter for the February session. And our view would be to try to have, in sum, a fairly consensus document ready for the consideration of your committee process as that comes into action. I presume it would be in January, if that's the schedule that would be intended. And what we've distributed to you, chairs and members, is a document that summarizes some of the basic principles that we think the emergent draft will address, and certain features that we think would also have to be addressed in the draft. So with that, Chair McPherson, Chair Pozanski, if there are any questions, we'd be happy to respond.
Myers, there is there are several holidays between now and January when this when the legislation would need to be introduced in advance of the session, and does that present any scheduling challenges in terms of getting the amount of work done that you anticipate needs to be done and to get this shaped up for that session?
Chair McPherson, Chair Pozanski, yes, I think, of course, it does add a challenge, but it would simply be one we would do our very best to surmount and try to work with as well as we could. We recognize that that process will have to move expeditiously. But I think there would be sufficient interest in the work itself that would be a motivating factor for the working group to try to make accommodations to the scheduling needs of the effort.
Questions from the group? Did you come in? Maybe it'd be helpful just to kind of flesh it out a bit. What would be the consequence of if we don't have such legislation passed in the supplemental session in February, and from when the constitutional amendments are enacted in
June, in 30 days after
in June, then we would have, without any implementation, the right, in effect, what I think I'm hearing is that the remedies that we will have created in the Constitution, or the people will have created, then really there will be no way to really apply them until there's implementing legislation. Is that in fact the case?
Chairman Person, Chair Pozanski, I think that's an accurate statement. It's, of course, I suppose, possible that the principal participants in the criminal justice system, perhaps even at the instigation of, say, my office, could attempt to work to try to arrive at some kind of understanding, sort of a concord at as to how they might, we might go about trying to activate the measures before the actual implementing legislation came into being. Though I think that would be a very rough and ready process, and certainly far, far less certain or satisfactory than the legislature is enacting how that system of enforcement and resolution is to operate, and what the specific responsibilities are of the principal participants, the district attorneys, the judges, victims, defense attorneys, probably those four, I guess.
Mr. Chair.
I mean, there's going to be a gap there of 6 to 7 months. I mean, and everything falls in place because in June, if it's enacted 30 days afterwards, we come back into session in the second week of January, and knowing just how long it would take to even get the committee up and running and expediting it, emergency proceedings to have it enacted and signed, we're talking some time before it can actually be realized.
If I could, Chairman Przewalski, I guess it's my view that as long as we don't create undue expectations, and no one can be sure in advance of this process whether we can produce a measure that the Assembly can successfully take as a starting point and act on, still it seems to me that it's an effort worth making, because I think the alternative of doing nothing and ensuring that there's going to be this hiatus is going to be a very, very unsatisfactory outcome. And I honestly think that the prospects for creating a recommended starting point that the Assembly can act on within the time constraints you've got are pretty good.
Senator Flores.
Perhaps a question more for you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Przewalski as well. As I understand it, you're recommending Attorney General Myers that we do some crafting of legislation that would be pending the disposition of ballot measures 49 and 50 in the May primary of 2008, et cetera, and then implementing language. Then, Chairs, respectively, how does all of that factor in? You mentioned the January time frame to work this in committee, but don't we have a committee bill or a bill drafting deadline facing us, the Senate today and House?
We have a deadline for submission of today for drafting of a concept. It would be my intention to urge the committee, the House committee, to embrace this as our committee concept to submit for drafting here today. The leadership has been urging us to have a consensus product. That is something that is not likely to divide the perspectives within the committee in getting ready for this session. This seemed to me to be a suitable subject matter for that purpose and timely and important work to do. So I would be offering it up for the committee's consideration when we get to the work session later this session. So you should have that in mind for your questions at here at this point, these witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted clarification that we were working within the deadline and the recommendation.
I'm told by leadership that it is a concept, even rather generally stated, is sufficient for action today, rather than having to have hammered out the kinds of details that will be worked through in the work group that Attorney General Myers has described.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisner.
I apologize to the Chair and to the Attorney General. I would ask a favor of the Attorney General. I represent District 53, and outside of questions and issues by Snowball, the most about Snowball, my biggest constituent inquiries now is about Baby Gabriel. And if the Attorney General would do us a favor of giving us some background by email, if you could ask your staff to give us that information, we can give our people what the situation is. We would appreciate it. Thank you.
Chairman First and Chair Przewalski, of course, Representative, we'll provide you what we can.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in anticipation of that, I had discussions with DHS on that matter, and I believe Representative Krieger has also, too. because Representative Krieger chairs a small work group on dependency issues, and I understand that the head of DHS is planning to convene what is called a
sensitive
review committee on this particular issue. What makes this whole area very difficult is most of the records are not confidential. They will not, the sensitive review committee will be able to see those records, but it will not be able to report on the factual issues involved. It may come up with its own recommendations. Representative Krieger was on the first sensitive review committee that we had a year ago, as was Representative Flores, so they are familiar with the process. But it is going to be convened.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking for, you know, we got people, if we can give them some information at the state, they're following DHS procedures, but I guess now the governor and the attorney general are going to look into how we can get around that or help this, because I have a lot of phone calls and emails.
The lawyers is really helping.
Are there any further questions for these witnesses? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming over to present you. Let's return to our panel on community corrections that we had last up. So if you could come forward again, that would be helpful.
I've got my question. It took me a while to realize who Snowball was.
Senator Brzezinski.
Steve, could you just tell us on your presentation, you talked...
I hate to interrupt, but didn't we have a motion on this?
No, we're not in work session yet.
Okay.
So we're both picking that up at the end of the meeting.
On your presentation, you talked about over 70% of those on supervision did not recidivate and new felony crimes. Can you give me the time frame that you were measuring? Was that 1 year, 5 years?
Co-chairs and Senator Brzezinski, we monitor recidivism. We define recidivism as a three-year period, and we identify that specifically for felony offenses as well.
Thank you.
Chair. Mr. Berger, so your presentation, we now have 18% increase after what we did last session for community corrections, and that's good. That gets you closer to your actual expenses. And then you go on to say, however, because of the other cuts in mental health and things like that, we're no better off. I understand what you're saying. I have a good working relationship with my community mental health people in Deschutes County. However, you would recognize that could even get worse if we don't get our timber payments straightened out, or the state doesn't address those communities and those counties that depend upon those timber funds. And that's something that this body and everyone should be concerned about and addressing.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, you nailed it. For those counties that are facing those potential losses, that is one of the significant motivators behind my statement that what I believe we are feeling in many counties is that, yes, the 18% increase definitely came closer to identifying our true costs of providing those services. But at the same time, we are really feeling, a squeeze in that community corrections, and I would probably expand that to say Department of Corrections cannot take sole responsibility for reducing recidivism on its own. For us to be successful, we need our community partners to address with us in a balanced approach between supervision, services, and sanctions the full needs of that offender. And what we are starting to feel is we have an offender that comes onto our caseload. We assess their need. We see the risk. The offender is ready to move, ready to do something, and at the same time, we can't get them into those services, sometimes for 30 to 60 days. As a department head, I start to feel some level of responsibility and I feel the responsibility and the liability. I know this risk, I know this need, but yet I cannot financially get this person into that service. And the loss of those of the timber receipts are just going to magnify those issues.
specifically to the mental health departments who rely upon those funds.
Thank you, Mr. McPherson. Chair McPherson. going to the treatment issue, potentially, depending on what happens in the election cycle in 2008 with various ballot measures that are proposed, we could be looking at really having to change how we do treatment, et cetera, and all of our public safety. Do you have any sense of what it might take for you to treat all the people in Klamath and Lake County that are under supervision? How much money it would take to close the treatment gap between those who need treatment and those who are not getting it?
Co-chairs, Representative Shields, my response, I will also attempt to maybe it will address Senator Witsit's question earlier that was asking what are the numbers in Klamath, that are on those waiting lists, if I remember that correctly. that's a big question, and I'm a little apprehensive in saying, here's the amount, here's the number, or I've oftentimes opened my mouth enough to go back to the office and find out, wow, that number took a life of its own and I was way off base. So I'm gonna try to respond and say I can provide the context, and what I would then do is commit to working in a subcommittee to try to, with our association and statewide, to get a more detailed number back. But to provide some context about where we are, and I can speak specifically to Klamath and Lake, within our annual budget, we expend close to $500,000 in subsidizing treatment services specific to domestic violence, sex offenders, alcohol and drug, and mental health services.
Keeping that cover.
And we also have a restorative justice family center focusing on victim needs and family issues. Within that dollar amount, within the $500,000 for Klamath and Lake counties, we currently experience a waiting list for alcohol and drug anywhere from 30 to 60 days. And in domestic violence, we have a waiting list approximately 30 days. We don't have the same waiting list in the other programs, but what we do have is, while we're expending $500,000 of the community corrections funds, it's similar to a medical model where there's a copay. In our jurisdictions, we subsidize the infrastructure of the program to make sure we can keep the doors open, but it requires a copay by the client to maintain and make sure it covers the full costs of providing that service. So in addition to our funding, the offenders are generally responsible for the monthly fees for services, which ranges anywhere from $35 to $50 per group, so that would be per week. And up front, you're usually looking at general assessments for most of those services, anywhere from $150 to $300 just to get in the door. So that provides a little bit of the context, and to probably help you a little bit additionally with that. For $500,000, that's roughly out of a budget of the $3 million budget annual.
Thank you very much. Representative Cameron.
I'm glad you brought that up. Just to place in context, of those copays, how much fees are generated from those copays from the offenders relative to the $500,000 on top of that, what's generated?
Co-chairs, Representative Cameron, again, there's that detailed question. I would be certainly willing to get that information and provide it as best I can.
That'd be great.
As far as the numbers that are under supervision, I can tell you, we have enrolled at any one time between those programs, we probably have roughly 700 offenders. It would really be a stretch, I think, to provide any detailed, what the collection rate is. Again, recognizing that just because that's what's being charged,
doesn't always mean that's what they're collecting. Oftentimes there's a bill. Most agencies allow the offender to attend for 2 or 3 sessions. If they pay up front, they get into treatment, they pay for 2 or 3 sessions, and they skip a couple payments, and it may take a few weeks to get the person discharged. So, but if that would be helpful to the representative, I would certainly attempt to gather as much information as I can.
Mr. Rasmussen, it looked like you had some...
I wanted to go back to Representative Shields' question, and again, Coach McPherson. In Clackamas County, I can tell you that we have about 3,000 people under supervision. About a third of those people are receiving services. So you can pretty much say that if 75% of the folks of that 3,000 are in need of those services, there's obviously a significant gap there receiving services. But I think there's a bigger trend that I'd like you all to hear about, and that is that, and Steve alluded to it in his presentation, and that is that just as several years ago when the mental health facilities closed down, the Department of Corrections became the quasi mental health holding facility. What's happening in the communities is that we are becoming, literally, I have to develop my own alcohol and drug programs. I have to have my own inpatient programs. I have to develop my own mental health programs. And I have to develop my own medication programs. Because we are not seeing those services as we used to see them for a number of reasons. And I'm not trying to point any fingers here. But the reality is if we believe something is necessary and worthwhile, we're almost at that point of being able to say we have to provide that. Because if we don't, then we're just saying, we're not going to worry about that. The question earlier about people coming out of the institution, they got their 30-day medication that the Department of Correction gives them. And that's great. That's better than it used to be. The problem is that once they get out to us, we don't have the resources to pay for what I have to tell you are some rather significantly expensive medications. And so we end up in a situation where we try to prioritize those things, and then we end up in situations in which we, quite honestly, go without. I had a PO come in my office the other day, and she said, we need to get this guy some medication. If he attacks my file cabinet one more time, I just don't think he's going to be successful. I said, yeah, you got a point there. So, I mean, there's some of those things that are going on that are trends that lead me to believe we're heading in that direction that kind of we headed with the mental health population back in the 70s.
Co-chairs, if I may add to that comment. One of the motivators there is the fact that community corrections is part of the criminal justice system and the social services system, we are the one agency that can't close our doors. From start to finish, jails have the capacity and they have the releasing authority to matrix out. When their jails are full, they have the authority to kick somebody out the door. The courts and the district attorney's office have a way of plea bargaining and moving their workload out of the system. Community corrections, we're the last door, we're the last agency in this system, and we cannot refuse to supervise this population, and we cannot ignore the needs that they want and the risk that they pose when they come into our office. And I think that's probably what I'm trying to emphasize.
Actually, I'm sitting here just biting my lips because in Clackamas County, we do. I mean, when you ask about treatment for a population, when I talk to you about treatment for a population, we're talking about the felony population. In Clackamas County, we don't even supervise non-person-to-person misdemeanors. Now, that's your thefts, and that's a lot of your stuff that is generated because of the drug use. We don't even supervise it because we don't have the local resources, or at least, let me put it to you this way, the local resources have been prioritized for person-to-person misdemeanors and DUII. And there isn't enough to go around for those non-person-to-person misdemeanors. So he probably has no way of saying no, but our commissioners say no at some point in time.
Senator Whipple? Thank you, Chair. First of all, I thank the panel. You guys represent from the Columbia River to the California border. It's pretty wide array here. The question that I'd actually
ask, I guess, Martin, that you referred to you was, do you have any way to estimate the number of drug-related property offenders who are not prosecuted, are not incarcerated, and who receive no treatment as a result of not enough funding and not enough space? And I, you know, you just answered the question within the system. Once they have been arrested, prosecuted, that you don't have the funding to maintain the proper control of those property offenders at this point. But there's still that group that are never prosecuted.
Chair, co-chairs, and Senator Whitsitt. I can't answer that question. What I can tell you, though, is that at least in Clackamas County, most of the folks that are fall into that category of non-person-to-person misdemeanors end up on bench probation. And the problem with bench probation is nobody knows how many folks are on bench probation. If you go to a judge and ask him how many people he's got on bench probation, he doesn't have a clue. And if you ask that statewide, nobody has a clue. So I would say it's significant, but I can't tie it down much more than that. You know, one of the things that happened, I'm sure you're familiar with the Crystal Darkness campaign that happened around the state for about a month or so ago. One of the nice things about that, and I haven't seen any of the data as far as how many people were referred and stuff like that, but they made a commitment that everybody that called their hotline number was going to receive some kind of referral for treatment. And in the end, it's kind of like the Department of Corrections. You need one more bed than you actually need. You need one more alcohol and drug slot than you actually have requests for. But it's hard to tie down to that specific number. We have a drug problem in Clackamas County. There's no doubt in my mind. But I can only really address that group of people that have gone through the formal process and have come to us.
Steve, could you address that from the other side of the state?
Co-chair, Senator Whitsitt, I'm going to probably do a redirect similar to Mark here. For those that are outside the system, I think the best way to probably accurately draw that number out would probably be through the judicial system and find out how many cases have been, that are outside. If I understood the question right, you're asking for the number of cases outside the corrections system that aren't receiving services. Is that?
Yes, those who have been arrested, either not prosecuted or have been prosecuted and simply turned loose. One of the things that comes to mind was the gentleman who had been arrested for drug-related crimes, I think, 5 times in 6 weeks, and then they finally killed 2 people and shot another girl in the head. That type of revolving door type thing they were not addressing, and he never hurt anybody before, so he must not have been violent.
Well, I think the co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, I think that is addressing probably the system's capacity, and it sounds like it's more the inability of the caseload pending prosecution and getting those. I mean, we were just testifying to the waiting list for treatment services and capacity within our services, and I think what you're looking at there is the criminal justice capacity for those who are pending trial, even pending getting into the criminal justice system with those pending arrests. But probably the best number, the best place to probably access those number of cases would be, I would assume, through the Criminal Justice Commission or maybe through the Judicial Department and find out how many cases are not getting into the system.
It'd actually probably be better to go to the DAs because they're the ones that with the charging. I mean, like in Lane County, we have a list of 130, 140 misdemeanors that are not being prosecuted, not even being touched. And now we've come up with a program which was developed while I was there that we're going to put people that are repeat offender, property offenders, into a DAP program, deferred adjudication, which is basically they pay $250 or whatever it is today. They get a booklet, they fill it out,
they send it in to somebody out of state, and they get it checked off. And I mean, the reality is that's for first-time offenders, not for these multiple offenders. But I mean, if you really want that, you need to go and find out how many have been arrested, and then they're being referred to the DA's offices, and because of the lack of resources or whatever it may be, prerogative, they're just not going forward on them.
Okay. Any further questions to the panel? And thank you very much. We appreciate your coming. And then the final panel on this topic, I have Devarshi Bajpai and Craig Prinz, although I see Mr. Prinz in the room.
He's circling the outside.
I don't see Mr. Prinz in the room either.
Well, we're relying on you, Mr. Bajpai.
I'm relying on Patsy.
Okay, there you are.
Chair McPherson, my name is Devarshi Bajpai. I'm members of the committee. My name is Devarshi Bajpai. I'm the Drug Court Grant Coordinator with the Criminal Justice Commission.
And I'm Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission.
Thank you. Well, we're at the time. I have some slides put together. You all have copies of them. I'm going to go through them fairly quickly, address the main points, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. The context of this is that House Bill 2485 in 2005 created the CJC Drug Court Grant Program. It provided $2.5 million in grant funds for drug courts. We worked with people, the state police, to provide another $1.5 million for drug court grants targeted at women, methamphetamine-using women. There was a competitive grant process. $4 million were distributed during the 06-07 fiscal year. There were about $10 million in applications that year. We have a system of monitoring and evaluation of the drug courts. We use, through the Chief Justice Advisory Committee on Treatment Corps, we developed a set of performance measures, including recidivism, drug use. All these measures are tracked through a data system managed by the Judicial Department. And then, in addition to that, myself and Diana Fleming from the State Police visit with all the drug courts that we contract with to just monitor and see what's going on. As far as the grants went, we have an average cost of how much we spent. In the expansion projects, in cases where there was an existing drug court, we were providing additional services. The average was $2,500 for implementation. New drug courts that were starting from scratch that had infrastructure costs, things like that, there was an average cost of about $5,700. This is some of the interesting stuff. As a result of the drug court grants, what happened? We know that the drug court population, since before the drug court started to now, has increased about 35%. Now, this is a drop in the bucket. As I think somebody mentioned earlier, there's about 35,000 felony offenders throughout the state that are under supervision. We're talking about 1,500 people in drug courts here. So it's a drop in the bucket, but it is a substantial increase from what it was before this grant program started. Not only has the number of people that are in drug courts increased, but the outcomes are getting better, too, because of the increased services that are available to the drug courts that are operating right now. We've seen about a 5-6% increase in the 90-day retention. When people are, any treatment less than 90 days long is not effective. Any treatment from 90 days to 6 months, that's where treatment effect, we start to see some treatment effect. So we know that there's been a substantial increase in the retention of drug court offenders. We also see a fairly good bump in the graduation rate from about 32% up to 47%. Now, we can't attribute these necessarily completely to the drug court grants, but it is, the timing coincides, so we think that they're definitely related. In addition to the data system, there's each burn grant that went out included a process evaluation. The process evaluation partly addresses the needs of Senate Bill 267, making sure that the drug court treatment programs are using evidence-based practices, that they're adhering to the 10 key components of drug courts. They're following a model that we know leads to good outcomes according to the research. In general, we know that drug courts are effective. I think we've talked to this group before about the effectiveness of drug courts. We've had several meta-analyses. Those are evaluation of evaluations. They typically use numbers of studies to look at what the average effect size is. They discount for study methodology, so if a study that they do is bad, then they discount the effect of that. What there's been at least four meta-analyses that I'm aware of on drug courts. All of them show strong effect size. That means that they have a very good effect on reducing recidivism. Government Accountability Office, they've done several studies on drug courts, and they found them effective at reducing recidivism. So drug courts in general, I think that there's not a lot of question at this point of whether in general they are effective. What we also know is that there have been several studies that have been done that have shown specific drug courts that have no effect. There's one or two studies that I'm aware of out of hundreds that have shown an increased risk of recidivism if a drug court was poorly implemented. I should note that none of the studies that have shown no effects or poor effect have been conducted in Oregon. There's a couple things that we know about drug courts, about what works and what doesn't work. These slides are from Dr. Latessa. He's with the University of Cincinnati. He presented here in Roseburg just a couple weeks ago. We know pre-adjudication courts tend to work better than post-adjudication courts. The effect size is slightly higher. I think that because the care is bigger for pre-adjudication offenders. We know that drug courts that target high-risk offenders have a better outcome than low-risk offenders. And we know that methamphetamine users are affected more by drug courts than people that use other drugs. One of the reasons for this might be that people that are in drug courts tend to have their average length of treatment in Oregon tends to be about 4 months longer than it is for people that are on probation. While they're on treatment longer, they get more effect, and about double the effect that other drug users do. I should also, most of the drug courts that we see, a good majority of the people are meth users, so drug courts are aware of this. What we're doing, we know, like I said, that in general drug courts are effective, but we want to evaluate our drug courts and direct our funds to the places where they have the most impact. To that effect, we are doing two things right now. One of the things that we're doing that's fairly exciting, and it's one of the first times that this has been done in this country, is evaluating the use of incentives in our contracts to reward performance. We're working with MPC Research, a company up in Portland that's done a lot of drug court research. We are going to have incentives built into some of our contracts when there's increases in performance from a baseline that we identify with the drug courts, with MPC research, there will be an incentive. During this period of time, MPC research is going to conduct an evaluation on whether those incentives help us get better outcomes and if it changes decision-making in a drug court, for example, if drug courts are cherry-picking or something like that in order to achieve the incentives. So that's something fairly exciting that we're doing. And the other thing is that we are looking at doing the recidivism study of adult drug courts in Oregon. We're still working on how we're going to do it, but there's a couple things that we're very committed to. We're looking at all participants. We don't want to just look at graduates. It's obvious that graduates are probably going to do better regardless of the outcome of the drug court or the effect of the drug court. So we're looking at all participants. We are going to use a comparison group of offenders that aren't in drug court, and we're using arrests and convictions as a measure of recidivism. A lot of the details behind those we haven't really worked out yet. So that's my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bajpai. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. It was very interesting. I wanted to go back to your slide that talked about the primary research results and the one that the third bullet that said you found at least one study that showed that there was an increase in recidivism, and that's shocking to me because it's a wonderful program and it should be everywhere significantly enlarged. But so can you give me just a little bit of what that showed? And why?
Chair is Representative Flores. One of the things that we've really stressed is the 10 key components of drug courts. Those require that all members of a drug court, the judge, the DA, the defense attorney, the treatment providers, everybody comes and works together collaboratively. In a drug court that calls itself a drug court, but one of those or two of those conditions are missing, the outcomes tend to be significantly worse. And what we found was, at least in one of those studies where we found a poor outcome, there was really poor judicial interaction. The judge was rotated, and judges didn't have a choice on whether they would serve on the drug court. When they came through, many offenders would have two or three judges while they were in the drug court. So those are some of the things that we see.
Quick follow-up. So there has to be, would suspect that part of that is a philosophical buy-in to the concept as well.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Representative Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably for Mr. Prinz. Property crime's been going down. In 2005, a 5% decrease. In 2006, a 16% decrease, according to FBI Uniform Crime Reports. Can you make any speculation on what might be driving that decrease in property crime over the last couple of years?
Chair, Senator Representative Shields, I'd be happy to. It always makes my staff nervous when I speculate, and we don't do it under statistical control. But I think what you're referring to is the 06 numbers for the FBI Uniform Crime Reports just came out a few weeks ago, I think. And that is the way that states can compare to other states. And so what the FBI does is it gets all of the information from Oregon through the Oregon State Police, and the property crimes are then indexed so you can compare them. So for the property crime index, they look at larceny, which would be theft, the way we think of it. They look at burglary, and they look at car break-ins particularly. And then they compare that to other states, and they compare that to the past. And this is for crimes reported to the police, and the reason we do that is we don't want to see ups and downs just because of enforcement changes or issues like they're being cited more or arrested less or things like that. The 06 numbers for Oregon, the index dropped 16.6%, which was the biggest drop that we have seen. In Oregon, I think Mike looked at it, I think, for a long time, 25, 30 years. And it took us out of the top 5, out of the top 10, out of the top 15 as far as that index. Why is, of course, the thing that we all want to know. Here's my speculation, and again, making my statisticians cringe. When you look at the big policy change in that time, to me, it leads you to the pseudoephedrine control, where there's fewer domestic labs. And the reason I say that is Oklahoma, if you look at Oklahoma that also did pseudoephedrine control, they had a double-digit reduction too. So it's an area that we're intrigued by and we're looking at. It's not, we can't control for all the statistical things. And to be honest, when we were doing the pseudoephedrine control, I thought the opposite would happen. I thought property criminals would have to steal more because meth would be more expensive if we controlled it. So we're looking into it. But that really is the big change that happened in 05, 06. And it's an intriguing area that I'm trying to work with the ONDCP back in Washington, D.C. to see if we can get the data from other states that had lab reductions and see if it lines up with the states that had property crime reductions. So, thank you.
Any further questions? Well, seeing none, then thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate the presentation.
Chair, it seems like we concluded the work that we have for right now. I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the Senate Judiciary Committee that's formed in a subcommittee and let you go forward with your work session. So the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting as a subcommittee will be adjourned for today.
And I will close the informational meeting and open a work session of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary. In committee, the only business we have before us is the consideration of concepts for submission for drafting by legislative council. And the only concept that we've brought forward at this point is the concept that was proposed by the Attorney General, which is implementing legislation for joint resolutions 49 and 50, which will be on the May ballot. In our last meeting, I had urged people to be thinking about any other ideas they wanted to have in the hopper, and I haven't seen actually ideas come forward, so this is the only one we have actively before us. But so I would urge consideration of this one, but I open it up for discussion of the committee if there are other ideas that I think the committee ought to be pushing forward. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am not at this point going to make a recommendation as we consider the driving while suspended issue, but I would like some nod of concurrence that's something that needs work that needs to continue as perhaps we look at the 09 session. But having said that, I do understand that Senator Winters will be coming forward with a driving while suspended piece of legislation that we will have to consider, and we'll probably see something, so I'm just a little concerned as we...
And because it is a bicameral process, of course, this doesn't preclude other issues from coming forward in the supplemental session, and in fact, because the rules that the Senate is working with, because of its smaller membership in terms of what can be brought forward, are more flexible, larger amount of activity that can be generated on that side of the building than in our chamber. It may well be that we'll be seeing some significant policy ideas coming forward from the other side that will then come onto our plate. But in terms of what we move forward, then we are limited to just one bill per committee for us to be submitted for drafting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other issue we haven't discussed in the two meetings that we've had since the session ended is I'm flying over the Christmas holiday, and I'm not sure how I'll get back on that plane without proper ID, so we haven't really addressed the Real ID Act or the immigration measure, which I guess February is too late anyway, so we're not going to get it done.
Maybe we'll get both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winston, that if you're not going to be back, we'll come with you.
Thank you.
We'll get you a bus ticket. I don't think you need that for
train.
A bus ticket.
Train.
And you do.
Train.
I want to kind of echo what Representative Flores said, and if, in fact, we can only consider one bill, there's not a problem with this issue that the Attorney General brought being proactive, but a little bit on the reactive side, I do hope that we will, based on the rules, we can only consider one bill on our side, but that we will make it a top priority to urge the Senate to hear Senator Winters and Representative Flores' concepts and ideas, and hopefully that would be a second priority that we could act on over here during the 08 session to come up with some solutions that would help us move towards solving, not that we will come up with a perfect concept, but that would help us move towards solving some of the issues that are plaguing. I know in this particular county, some of those things that were referenced actually happened here and are pretty high on people's radar screens that we act on.
Well, I appreciate the work that Representative Flores and Senator Winters have done on this subject. I mean, it is clearly something the public is disturbed about. It's a real problem. The solutions are a little more slippery, as we discovered from some of the presentations today, but it's obviously something we need to keep focused on, and I appreciate that work, and we look forward to having something come forward, maybe as early as a supplemental session, but certainly in the 09 session.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, my concern is that as I understand the protocols here, the House side is really precluded from submitting a concept to even be drafted. So therefore, a lot of the information, the potential solutions, even those outlined, the five solutions that Judge Todd talked about, which were very much compatible and parallel with the work that our group had done, would possibly be precluded from the limited scope of, as I understand, Senator Winter's bill, which I think was very much part of the discussion. So how, I'm not sure how we would factor all that into if we even get to that point. So do you understand my puzzlement?
Well, but I guess I don't, Representative, because I would imagine that even if the content of Senator Winter's bill doesn't have all the ideas that might be ultimately be in play, that would be a vehicle with which one could consider all the variations.
I guess what I'd like to hear you say is that once there is a vehicle in play, we will be able to have some opportunity to then to expand, enhance, or recraft.
If within the scope of the related clause, any piece of legislation can be amended with whatever goes into it. And I think one of the strategies that I've already observed are rather expansive relating clauses for this supplemental session in order to give the limited amount of legislation the maximum amount of potential scope.
That could be good news and bad news. But then, and a follow-up to Representative Wisnett, I do believe that there is a deadline or timeline that has been extended, so you will be able to get back here without your passport on your airplane.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee accept the Attorney General's recommendation that we submit as our committee bill request to Council for the conceptual bill to enforce House Joint Resolutions 49 and 50 that are passed by the people.
Representative Wisnett has moved that the Attorney General's proposed implementing legislation for House Joint Resolutions 49 and 50 be submitted as our legislative concept for drafting. Is there a discussion of the motion? If not, Representative Kramer.
Sure, just so that those concepts, when we actually see them, are inclusive enough and cover those issues to the liking of the legislature, we may have to amend them.
Oh yes. This is to get drafting authorized, and there will be a work group where it's going to flesh out the details between now and mid-January, and the bill that is the result of that drafting and the work group's work will have to come back to for introduction as a bill. So there's a further action of this committee before it could even be introduced in this supplemental session.
Chairman of the committee, I understand that the deadline of voting for a bill is different in the House than it is the Senate. I think for the Senate it's the 18th of January. I believe for the House it's the 30th of January, which may cause problems concerning trying to meet together.
Finding a January meeting day might be a rest of tension within the two committees. Yeah. Any further discussion of the motion?
Then, if not, let's call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Excuse.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Comp.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chairman Hurst.
Aye. Motion carries. The legislative concept is approved for submission to Legislative Council. That concludes the work of our work session and our agenda for the day. Thank you for your attendance. We're adjourned.
Next meeting.